fear, and I have said months ago that Assange's days in the embassy are numbered, according to Rafael Correa. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has been staying in the Ecuadorian embassy in London since 2012. He was granted asylum by former President Correa to help Assange avoid extradition to the United States, where he would face the death penalty for charges of espionage and treason. Last week, Ecuadorian President Lenin Moreno, who was visiting Spain, told reporters that Assange would eventually have to leave the embassy, but argued that his exit had to be obtained through dialogue. Moreno also confirmed Ecuador has been engaging in diplomatic talks with the United Kingdom to determine Assange's fate.
Members of social movements from different states of Brazil are on a hunger strike to protest the imprisonment of former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva and rising poverty in the country. At a press conference in the Brazilian capital, João Pedro Stedile from the Rural Landless Movement said the measure has been called for by the Via Campesina as an extreme act of pressure on the government. Six militants from different social movements began the hunger strike and will be supervised by a doctor in order to avoid risk to their health.
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
On the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
If we had enough concern about Hillary's emails to do 9 investigations in the House and 2 in the Senate and have hundreds of hearings on that issue because we thought a U.S. official mishandled their emails, hundreds of hearings, and we have 2, when every single intelligence agency in this country tells us that the Russians hacked our election. 2 hearings. 2 hearings. That's it. After a year and a half. This used to be the Oversight Committee. This is the running away from Oversight Committee. Since Trump took office, we do 0. I'm surprised we're having this hearing today. I'm shocked. Because the Republican effort has been to rally around the president, even when he is wrong, even when he puts down publicly our intelligence agencies, even when he disses us and sides with Putin. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? This is where we're at now. This is a disgrace, a disgrace. That was a national embarrassment in Helsinki. I was embarrassed that our president was siding against our intelligence agency, and those people work hard. You all work with them. You work with the NSA. You work with CIA. You know the good work that they do. And our president threw them under the bus in front of the world to side with Putin. You got to be kidding me. It's time to decide what you stand for. Do you stand for democracy? Or you stand with that gangster in Moscow? Do you stand for the right for your people to have a clean and honest election? Or do you want to cozy up to the president? You don't want to make him look bad. I can understand when there's gray issues, but this is black and white. Come on.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight for indigenous rights.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Indian land! Indian land! Indian land! Indian land!
You guys have no jurisdiction here.
Indian land!
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligent Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro. That's nothing. What were you before the white man mean you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What tongue did you speak? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians, all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. The white man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for the smart of the region.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Intelligente de Indigena.
In Newington, Connecticut, line for independence. Mary Lou, good morning.
Good morning. I'll try not to sound too awful, but I want to thank the Russians for interfering with our election to stop Hillary Clinton from becoming president. That woman has got illusions of grandeur. And so hasn't her husband. That man, the whole time he was in the White House, was just fooling around sexually with Monica Lewinsky. He is an accused rapist. He has never denied it. And his wife never did anything to stop him from doing that.
Mary Lou, let me ask you, do you think Russian interference was the reason that President Trump won in 2016?
Yes, because the Russians interfered. I mean, what would we do with Hillary in that White House? That woman, she doesn't know what she was doing. What a mess she made of Benghazi. What she did with those emails to put a server in her living room or wherever she put it.
That's Mary Lou.
Internet radio for smarter than smarter.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the Fourth World from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, Salutan and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, the Angry Indian, editor-in-chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the people of the Fourth World from AboriginalNewsWire.tumblr.com and AboriginalPress.wordpress.com, as well as our main news portal, ang-newswire.blogspot.com. And along with my co-executive producer and master studio engineer extraordinaire, Ms. Guadalupe Morales, we welcome you back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the official broadcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service, coming straight at you from Everyman Studios in unceded Chinook and People's Territories, North America. Where do you want me to start today? With Rick Gates? Was it late last night? It was late yesterday, right, Lou? Rick Gates has pled guilty to, a whole host of crimes. But, you know, let's just focus for a second on what no one else is really saying. But it's pretty evident if you're not a square. Paul Manafort, or Manafort Day, depends on who you want to talk to, right? But Paul Manafort, besides working for the Russians and the Ukrainians and the Cosa Nostra in the United States, has worked for the administration. He was running the election campaign until, you know, some things popped up that Trump and company couldn't really explain away, so then he left, right? Left under a cloud. And, you know, all kinds of things popped up. that you know, he was working as a foreign agent, about registering as a foreign agent. Where do you want me to go? But anyway, Paul Manafort is dirty as a motherfucker, and Rick Gates is working with him. Right? This is his right hand, and it turns out that Gates has admitted, has confessed to, has pled guilty to. Manafort has pled guilty. I mean, they're all pleading guilty. Flynn has pled guilty. Papadopoulos has pled guilty. Roger Stone will plead guilty. They're all pleading guilty to keep the pressure from getting worse. You understand? But in the case of Rick Gates, it's a little different. Rick Gates was not only a part of these ripoffs with Manafort. He was ripping off Manafort. Let me say that again, so that you understand what I'm talking about here. If you're from the streets, you know exactly what the fuck I'm talking about here. Paul Manafort works for the mafia. Okay? Donald Trump takes money from the mafia. Donald Trump launders money for the mafia. Donald Trump has been dealing with the mafia ever since his casinos fucked up in Atlantic City, New Jersey. So, here it is. Paul Manafort, who has all of these connections to the Italian mob here in the United States, he has the connections to the Russian Vori, or Bratva, depending on what language you want to use, right, in the Russian Federation, which is connected to the FSB, which is connected to Putin directly. Putin directly. You understand what I'm saying? When Litvinenko got killed, he was poisoned in London, it was because he was outing the links. He had a small group of intelligence officers in the FSB were outing the links between Putin and the Bratva in that country. So, Manafort is a gangster. I mean, there's a lot of talk about his ostrich jacket and what have you, whatever. Manafort is a gangster. So, Rick Gates works for Manafort as his right hand. Manafort is laundering money for the mob. Manafort is doing all kinds of things. He's the go-between. He's the fixer. People are talking fixer in terms of Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen was just a lawyer. Michael Cohen might have fixed a few things. But let's just be honest. If you look at Michael Cohen on film, all of these clips we're seeing in the news, and you look at Manafort, who do you think is the real motherfucking gangster? Who do you think is the real hood between these two? Michael Cohen is a mob lawyer. That's all there is to it. He is a mob lawyer. On the other hand, I'm pretty sure Manafort has rearranged some fucking noses, has broken some legs in his day. Yeah, I can pretty much fucking guarantee it. You know, without having to get into a discussion about why I understand all this shit. But see, but the mainstream news is not talking about it like this, even if they do understand it. Because it makes it clear what the fuck has been going on. That the mafia is that deep in the fucking United States government. Now, I know a lot of people out here who are self-educated historians who have their IceCast shows, who listen to Alex Jones, who probably believe that QAnon is a real goddamn conspiracy. And did you see that, Lou? The transgendered woman who was on, I saw her on MSNBC. You heard about it, but you don't know. Yeah, because everybody's talking about it down here. I don't even know who this person is. It looks like they're in their mid-20s. But there was a transgender woman down here who got punched in the face a couple of times over the weekend while Patriot prayer, led by Joey Gibson, a half-Japanese, and Tiny, whatever the fuck his name is, because I don't care. He's Samoan. But they're out here leading these Nazi rallies and shit. And, you know, Gibson is running for office. So they came up, they showed up on here last weekend. And fucking, you couldn't even walk downtown. There was just so many goddamn cops, right? And they were cruising ahead before. They were looking at me. They were looking at anybody that, I don't know how they were defining what the fuck an anti-racist, anti-fascist activist looks like. But I had done my business down there and then went back to see what the fuck was going on during the protest and couldn't get down there. So apparently this transgender woman got punched in the face a couple of times. She was on the news saying that, you know, she had things thrown on her, all kinds of, all the usual complaints, right? She spit on, this, that, and the other. But understand something. She's transgendered and wearing a big QAnon homemade t-shirt standing out there with Patriot prayer. You know, yeah, I mean, the Nazi scene here in Poland, yeah, I know I'm going on a tangent. The Nazi scene here in Poland is a motherfucker. Yeah, it's led by non-whites. And then you had Tan, I call her Tan the agent. She's been in Willamette Week for being a snitch. She's Asian. She's Korean. And she ratted out Antifa members last year or earlier this year, something like that, right? But in any case, it's a really weird situation down here. But anyway, back to Gates and Manafort and Trump. What I'm trying to say is here, and I apologize for that tangent. Oh, well, yeah, I didn't even, sorry, Lou. Lou's right. I didn't finish what I was saying. Yeah, well, this transgender woman got punched in the face here. She says by Antifa people. She says she was punched. I don't know. I didn't see it. But it's the fact that she was standing there with a QAnon t-shirt when QAnon is bullshit and she's transgendered and she's standing there with neo-Nazis. Well, Stephen Miller, the other thing this morning, who is Jewish, is now, if you're a legal immigrant, they want you out of here. If you've ever used Obamacare, if you've ever had a parking ticket, if you've ever used any sort of services, if you ever got a HUD loan or anything, that's your ass. Right. If you've ever gone to the doctor under Obamacare and you're a legal immigrant, you're fucked. And they're also talking about stripping people who have been naturalized because they've used these services. So you're fucked. So anyway, back to what? Oh, I didn't finish. Oh, well, what I was going to say was, and if you have a problem with this, have a problem with it. What the fuck was a transgender woman doing wearing a QAnon shirt standing with the goddamn Nazi, standing with Patriot Prayer? What the fuck is that? What the fuck is that? And then what am I supposed to say? She didn't deserve to get assaulted? Well, no, I don't believe anybody necessarily needs to be or should be subject to assault. But wait a goddamn minute. These motherfuckers are talking about killing non-whites. These motherfuckers are talking about killing Jews. These motherfuckers are talking about killing transgender people. So, yeah, you know, if you don't find that confusing, then, you know, fuck you. Because what the fuck are you listening to this broadcast for? No, I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, well, you know, anyone wearing a QAnon shirt who supports Patriot Prayer, you know, just walk right up to them and beat the shit out of them. No, that's not what I'm saying. See, that's what they're saying. And then they're out here saying this. And this transgender woman is out here advocating for this and then complaining when she gets punched in the face. You know, like I've complained here when folks say, well, you know, you can't say anything about Milo Yiannopoulos. He's gay and, you know, he has a right to be a Nazi if he wants to. He has the right to his opinion. And I'm like, yeah, he's running around doing a dangerous faggot tour. I'm the gay man who's going to tell you what you need, what you don't know about what's going on out here in the world. And then he, at the same time, gives a pass to pedophilia. He gives a pass to racism. Not one man gives a pass to racism. Let me correct myself. He got Leslie Jones basically thrown off of fucking Twitter and said that he had a right to do it because she was black and ugly. I didn't even know anything about Leslie Jones until all of that bullshit started, because I don't go to the movies. I don't watch television. I don't pay attention to this shit. You know, what happened to all that Wakanda bullshit, right? Right? You know, you had for like, what, a good month, man, around me anyway, black folks that were literally telling their black children that Wakanda was a real place and that, you know, the movie was real, that this was a real thing. And then when I said to them, you shouldn't be doing that. We have enough trouble trying to educate our kids on what's fucking factual as it is in the midst of all this misinformation. Why would you do that? And, you know, I'm an Uncle Tom and Wakanda does exist, and that the cat that did it, Ryan Coogler, whatever, nigga, I never heard of him before this, that he did a power move by bringing this out. Because, you know, all this history is going down in Africa. They don't know about Wakanda. You know, the film is right there. Yeah, yeah. So in the meantime, while he's concentrating on this and teaching his children complete bullshit, Diamond and Silk are out here taking money to support neo-Nazis. I'm not talking about Trump. I'm talking about real motherfucking neo-Nazis. Paris Denard is out here supporting real Nazis. Courtney West is out here talking about, well, you know, I welcome a Nazi government if it comes with love. That's what she said on Twitter. Go to my Twitter feed, at The Angry Indian, and look for it. But back to Gates and Manafort. What I'm trying to say is that Manafort was laundering money, been laundering money for the mob, moving money around, opening up doors for them, this, that, and the other. Gates works for him. Gates has said in court that he's been ripping Manafort off for a little while they were doing all of these scams. So he's been skimming the skim. So whose money is he taking? Is he taking Manafort's money or is he taking mob money? Think about it. Let that trickle down for a second. This motherfucker was working for Manafort. He was robbing Manafort, who was skimming. So he was skimming the skim. That's supposed to go to the Italians or to the Ukrainians or to the Russians. Gates, Rick Gates, is testifying and pleading guilty to save his own motherfucking life. Do you understand what I'm saying? Do you understand where this is going? The mob is so goddamn deep in the Russian and American governments at this point that Rick Gates would rather plead guilty and go ahead and do his federal bid rather than take a motherfucking chance of trying to hide the fact that he was robbing Manafort, that he was skimming the skim that they were, you know, taking from these banks, from the NRA, whatever the fuck, you know, all of this shit they were doing. Because, I mean, you got all these female Russian spies down here because they know that American men are weak. Men are weak, period, when it comes to that shit. I mean, the whole thing about the honeypot bit, I mean, it worked on Assange, didn't it? It worked like a fucking charm on Assange. And you know, they got him and they fucked him up and they got him where they wanted to. And I don't give a fuck about him either, you know, because there's so many goddamn people out here who are trying to defend Assange to me, knowing full motherfucking well that Assange is dirty, that Assange has been working with the Russians, like Edward Snowden, like probably Glenn Greenwald. I said it the last broadcast. I'll say it again. You know, that these fuckers are playing the left like a violin. You know, Julian Assange is not, I mean, he supported Ron Paul, he supported Rand Paul. He is not a motherfucking liberal. He never fucking was. You know, just because these guys were willing to do the collateral murder information leak, it's because most of these guys, these extreme far right motherfuckers are anti-war because they feel that all of that effort, all of that money, all of that focus should be on domestic protecting white people. You know, they have the same philosophy that Israel has. You know, I mean, Israel cannot fight a fucking international conflict. You think Israel could really go to war with Egypt? Do you really think that they could go to war with, like, Syria, say? No. They don't know how to do that anymore. They know how to stomp on Palestinians. You know, I mean, they have the mindset that they're stepping on cockroaches, right? So they know how to fight Palestinians. They know how to fuck up Palestinians. They know how to engage with the settlers, these crazy-ass fucking extremist settlers, to go after Palestinians. But do you think they could actually defend Israel from an outside aggressor without the United States' help? No. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. There's been so many IDF and British military experts that have talked about this. I've heard a couple of NATO people talk about this. Israel is only designed to do one goddamn thing. Stomp on and eradicating the indigenous population. They're not about anything else. And, you know, they just passed this goddamn law that, you know, JSOL, the Jewish state in the Levant, is exactly by law now what it is. So they can't get mad when you say shit like this. You can't get mad when you say that they can't get angry, I'm saying, when you say the Jewish state in the Levant, because that's exactly what they just passed the motherfucking law to authenticate. They are a Jewish state, so they have no room for anybody else. So, you know, all of the weapons that they design and the additions they've been making to Krav Maga, because you notice all of their weaponry now, you know, it's made for urban conflict. It's made for urban conflict. They buy their other long rifles and shit from the fucking United States because there's a contract for that. But if you look at what is developed in Israel, for Israeli use, used by, IDF, Mossad, Shin Bet, unit, pick a number, right? You know, all of these goddamn things. The Navy, all of that bullshit, they're all snub-nosed, everything is for close quarters combat. Everything. And why is that? Because they're fighting inside their own fucking home. They're fighting the people who are already goddamn there. An extended thing? Absolutely not. They can't fucking do it. and what else was it? Yeah, that I'm just finding this out. Apparently, the article's from 2015 that Breitbart was actually started with Netanyahu's help in Israel. It was actually started in the state of Israel. I didn't know that. You know, I mean, you would think that they hate Jews, and they do. But, you know, they got that whole Christian-Jewish thing going on, and Israel, well, they figure, fuck it, you know. Andrew Breitbart was a fucking moron, so, you know, we'll use him, because he's open to being used. Yeah, I know a lot of people still deifying that motherfucker. Fuck him. It is what it is. He was a lying son of a bitch when he was alive, and there's no reason now to respect the fact that he's dead, because, you know, if he was still here, he'd be lying. He'd still be lying like a fucking cheap rug, so it doesn't fucking matter. And, no, I mean, there's no real point of me being in here. We're going to play some audio, but there's no real point of me being in here because, you know, Trump is a lying son of a bitch. Oh, what else came out yesterday? What I've been saying without even having any motherfucking anything in front of me. John Bolton admitted there's no goddamn deal with North Korea. Trump was lying like a motherfucker. There's no deal with North Korea. There never was a goddamn deal with North Korea. And now he's trying to ratchet shit up with Iran because, you know, all of this shit is closing in on him because, you know, Rick Gates has admitted to robbing his goddamn boss. Stealing the fucking, you know, skimming off the skim, stealing the fucking mob money that they were fucking ripping off. And laundering and shit. So, you know, I mean, he's trying to protect himself at this point from Navarri and from La Cosa Nostra. Right? And probably from the fucking Ukrainian mob. And they're no goddamn joke either. You know, because you can't rob them and think that, you know, it's just going to be over. You know, that shit don't work, man. That don't work. You know what I'm saying? He'd rather go ahead and do his bid in the Fed than rather have to deal with these motherfuckers, which, you know, that he can get to him in there too. You know, I mean, this is all a fucking mess. So Trump is a goddamn liar about the Trump Tower meeting. He's admitted that his son, his wonderful son, was up there trying to get dirt on Hillary Clinton. And this is why Giuliani's been running around like a fucking chicken. You know, because collusion is not a crime. Collusion is not a crime. And, you know, Trump's been on fucking Twitter. You know, collusion is not a crime. Collusion is not a crime. Why are they doing this? Because they fucking colluded. They fucking colluded. And they're being supported by a group of black leftists, black Republicans, Latino conservatives who are only against the Trump administration right now because Latinos are being hurt, because their families are being fucking kept out, because their families are being fucking locked up, because their families are being pumped full of drugs, because their fucking families are being raped. Because these same fucking Latino conservatives, when you talked about black and Native American people in these same fucking conditions, they would tell you, get a goddamn job. Go to school. And these things won't happen to you. Right? But now that the Latino community is being fucking torn up, now they're like, oh, well, you know, Trump needs to go. He needs to be removed from office. How many of these motherfuckers voted for him? How many? And I told you, Luke, you know, I'm fucking tired of putting up with people's bullshit. You got so many goddamn Spanish-speaking folks in this country. And I've known them on both sides of this fucking country, East and West goddamn coast, who talk shit about how great this place is, about how it doesn't make any mistakes, it's not racist, and you know, you niggas are fucking lazy, and da-da-da, I'm a Marine, I'm in the Army, blah-blah-blah, I'm better than you, fuck you, simplify, blah-blah-blah-blah, and now I'm watching a bunch of these fuckers in the street here, crying like a motherfucker. Right, Lou? Crying in the fucking street at the goddamn remittance fucking stops, where they send money to Mexico, send money to wherever the fuck they come from. These same goddamn people are calling people niggas, right? Calling fucking, have the nerve to call Indian people prairie niggas because they learned that bullshit in the fucking military. Now they're getting kicked out of here. Now what? You know, the same people who were fucking, you know, just been in the country 5 minutes. Oh, these black people are lazy. Oh, these motherfucking black people lazy. You know, I mean, the black community has a hell of a lot of fucking problems here. You know, I'm the first to fucking admit that. You know, I've never shied away from that. And anyone that says that isn't paying attention. You know, I'm not liked, loved by the black community. You know, it's like, you know, where the fuck did y'all get that idea? I'm out here fucking telling the truth. That fucking Hoteps have sold you out. They're working with the fucking Nazis. Farrakhan, now that Alex Jones has been banned from all these fucking social media sites except motherfucking Twitter. How many times has Farrakhan been on the Alex Jones show? A Model Technique has been on the Alex Jones Show. Larry Pinkney, I believe, has been on the Alex Jones Show. Who the fuck are you going to trust? You know, I mean, Farrakhan is pushing Scientology in the Nation of Islam. What the fuck? Scientology, the cat that founded Scientology was a fucking racist, L. Ron Hubbard. The Scientology itself is fucking racist. What the fuck is going on here? So, you know, really, that's why, you know, this dispatch, we're just going to play some audio, I think, right? Because there's really not too much I can say. What can I say? What is there for me to say? You know, everything is fucking, you know, just totally goddamn crazy. And nobody wants to admit to they're part of the fucking problem. Their acquiescence is part of the fucking problem. White liberals making excuses for why I'm supposed to respect their racist fucking uncle is part of the goddamn problem. I stopped talking to Bob Kincaid. No, we've never met, but we worked together on in this medium here for a few years. But I stopped talking to Bob Kincaid because I got tired of white liberals telling me, well, if you help me, then somehow it later on we'll be able to do something for you. How many fucking more decades am I supposed to hear that shit under what's going on with Trump? Under a situation with the DNC, under Debbie Rasmussen Schultz and fucking Hillary Clinton, pretty much edged this fucking thing where they want it and left Sanders out in the motherfucking wind, leaving all of the people who identify themselves as Democratic Socialists out in the goddamn wind. Tom Perez isn't doing anything at all. When do you ever see him in the news? What is he doing? What is the DNC doing? They're not doing a goddamn thing. They're not motherfucking fighting. They're corporate fucking Democrats, and that's what they're doing. But at the same time, you got Black Agenda Report that gets respect for what? They're out here defending Julian Assange, who is a fucking racist that's got connections to the goddamn far right. They're out here defending Putin, who is defending fucking Nazis in his own goddamn country, and they're defending Trump. I played you the audio of the last fucking dispatch. I didn't know how that's how Lupe was going to do it. But the guest, Dr. Tony Monteiro, says that the anti-Trump movement is a corporate movement from above. What the fuck is he talking about? He's an analyst? He is a left-wing communist analyst? What the fuck is he talking about? Is it the anti-Trump movement is a corporate movement from above? Those are the motherfuckers that have been defending him because he's giving them everything that they want. EPA rules? Forget it. Labor rules? Forget it. Human rights? Forget it. I'm talking about domestic. He says that the Nazis have a point. There's good people over there. But this is who the black communists, the black leadership in terms of the left in this country. Because that's my main problem, Luke, is that Black Agenda Report is considered the vanguard. Not Uhuru, you know, down there in Florida. Black Agenda Report, even though they've been talking the same old bullshit for years. They haven't said anything goddamn new. They work with CPR Metro, another old school fucking lefty. Don DeBar, they're not saying a goddamn thing, you know, other than, well, you know, the United States is so fucked up, it's not even worth talking about. And we really need to be helping, you know, the Russians and doing this and doing that. Anything to make a crack and shit so that basically we can sell more fucking newspapers and confuse the situation even more, because that's really what the fuck we're about. We're not asking about any goddamn politics. I suppose if you ask them over there, Black Agenda Report, what the fuck they're about, they'll tell you socialism, but they're really not about a goddamn thing. You know, they're not about anything. You know, they're playing the same role that this transgender chick did in Portland. You know, I'm part of a super minority that gets stomped by Nazis. So like Milos Yiannopoulos, I'm going to go work with the Nazis because somehow that makes me edgy and it puts me, you know, in this particular space that makes me better than somebody, any goddamn body. And that's the ridiculous fucking politics we're dealing with down here in Portland. Lupe's going to do whatever she's going to do. So that's it for today. It's total madness, and there's really no point in my talking about it at this point. There's nothing to say. I mean, that's how fucking bizarre all of this shit is. And I know I'm preaching to the choir, but still, when people of color are working with Nazis, that's a problem, don't you think? When transgender people are willing to work with Nazis, when immigrants are willing to work with Nazis, that's a problem, don't you think? Alright, we're going to take a break so stations may identify themselves. This is the Angry Indian, and you are listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please, stay tuned.
This is Violent Fanone, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Wait. I got to share this one with you. This one almost made me cry this morning out of rage. This was at Raw Story. A wealthy white teenager who was allegedly a member of a South LA street gang and participated in the murder of a black pedestrian has walked free after his lawyers argued that, quote, he was open-minded to friends from different backgrounds, end quote. Cameron Terrell, 18, of Palos Verdes Estates, a very Tony neighborhood, was a member of a majority black gang. His nickname was White Boy, and he sometimes appeared in the background of rap videos. The white teen admitted that he was with two armed black teens who shot Justin Holmes, 22, to death because they suspected he was a member of a rival gang and on their turf. Justin Holmes was not a gang member. He was a college student. White Boy parked the getaway car, his father's car, so that the other two teenagers could sneak up on the college student. The white boy later recorded a video of his fellow gang members kicking over memorial candles that had been left for the dead college student. The white boy had faced a $5 million bond, and his parents, bless their hearts, paid $500,000 cash to get him out of jail before trial. The defense attorney handling white boy and white mom and white dad said this, quote, Cameron Terrell, white boy, did not possess any weapons. He did not shoot anybody. He was not part of any conspiracy or any plan or plot. At best, the evidence suggests that Cameron was a witness. And the defense attorney added that his white boy client made a good story because of his, quote, background, his family, where he resides, and his school, end quote. Motherfucker. I always thought that the person who drove the getaway car, isn't that how they got Patty Hearst and charged her with murder one? She drove a getaway car? Or, I mean, isn't that what they said? I mean, isn't that part of the criminal code? You're involved in a crime where somebody's killed. You're as guilty as the person who pulled the trigger. But not if you're a white boy. And the other two are black. Oh, the two black guys? The two black teens who white boy drove to the killing? They're still in jail. Waiting trial. Unfucking real. And white boy yelled into the camera, some TV camera, as he left the courtroom. White boy goes, rest in peace, Justin Holmes, the college student that was killed. I don't have to explain myself to anyone. God knows what really happened that day, and God knows what was in my head that day, end quote. So fuck you. I'm white. I go free. My mama and daddy put up $500,000 in cash. White boy. Wealthy white teen who drove getaway car in L.A. gang murder of innocent black man goes free. Give me a break.
Radio Anguindian. Anguindian Radio for the Fourth World.
Caution. If you are turned off by the truth of what's happening on the street today, turn your attention away. Nigga Lover, the movie they tried to stop. So real, so violent, so brutally honest that only a few theaters dare to show it. Nigga Lover, where black and white passions explode. The chase that begins with love and ends with violence. Not just another black movie, different than all the rest. See Nigga Lover, the movie they tried to stop.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that prevents pregnancy. It is not an abortion pill and does not cause an abortion, only the prevention of pregnancy. If you have had unprotected sex or have been raped and need Plan B, contact your local Indian Health Service. You have a legal right to receive Plan B over the counter, meaning without a prescription or a doctor's appointment if you are 17 or older. Plan B must be taken within 72 hours of sexual intercourse to be effective. For more information, call 605-487-7072. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Radio Insurgente, la voz de los sin voz.
Vamos, 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 vamos adelante, para que salgamos en la lucha avante, porque nuestra patria grita y necesita de todo el esfuerzo de los zapatistas.
Transmitiendo desde algún lugar de las montañas del sureste mexicano, en la frecuencia 99.7 en FM.
I'm gonna stand until I can't stand no more if I have to stand by myself.
The American people are the last people to wake up.
Prisons are becoming an integral part of the U.S. economy.
People of color organize critical thinking, strategic work, and direct action for social, racial, gender, and economic justice.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
People of Color Organize features intersections of race, politics, feminism, movement, class, internationalism, and theory.
This is about the Black Panthers. This is about the American Indian movement. This is about all of us.
Visit us online at peopleofcolororganize.com. Follow us on Twitter at POC Organize and Facebook at facebook.com/peopleofcolororganize. You can also find us on Tumblr at peopleofcolor.tumblr.com.
We're organizing against what we term genocide.
Missy Elliott for the Black AIDS Institute.
HIV happens to us more than it does anybody else, which is why we should all get tested, because if we don't step up, then nobody will.
Get informed, get tested, get treated, and get involved. For more information, call the Black AIDS Institute at 213-353-3610. That's 213-353-3610. Or online at www.blackaids.org.
Hello. This is a message to the so-called New Black Panther Party, which resides in the United States of America. As an American citizen, I ask that you all immediately disband and stop what you are doing, which is misrepresenting an organization and a culture that you do not understand. As the child of a Black Panther, I was raised to understand that the ideals of a Black Panther shall live on. However, the physical representation of a Black Panther can and will be oftentimes misrepresented and imitated. These gentlemen are Black Panthers, and they also have the original mindset of a Black Panther, which is to ensure truth, justice, and equality for every single tax-paying American citizen, regardless of the color of their skin or their ethnicity. God bless you, and power to the people.
And let's start right there, 2018-2020. Paris Dunard, CNN political commentator and member of President Trump's advisory board, is with us this morning. Paris, good morning to you.
Hi, good morning.
All right, so you've got millions of, we have millions of African immigrants, hundreds of thousands of Haitian Americans in this country, American-born blacks offended by the comments from the president. What does this mean for your party?
Well, what this means for the Republican Party is that we've got to do what the original intent of that meeting was about, which is to get to the bottom of the immigration system and put together a positive policy that is putting America first, securing our borders, and fixing this DACA issue. So for the party, moving into 2018, we've got to show the American people that we heard them, we hear them, and that we are serious about fixing the illegal immigration problem, one, and two, putting that so the Congress can finally do their job and do something about DACA. That is what the party has to do. We've got to get back on focus, back on message about fixing this issue once and for all.
So a legislative fix will certainly, and I'm sure everybody hopes that it happens before the government runs out of money so that the U.S. government does not shut down. But the damage created by the president's comments, the characterization of African nations as shithole countries, or saying, why do we need more Haitians? Take them out. What that means for the party. There's the damage created by the rhetoric aside from the policy. How does the president fix that if he's not even acknowledging that he said it?
Well, I think, you know, if you go to the sentiment about Haiti, I think and I guess we all wish we were in the room to hear context and hear all of what was going on and see how it was proposed to him. But if someone mentioned Haiti as being added to this and saying we need more Haitians, I think it's perfectly okay for the president to ask the question to the person asking him, why do we need more Haitians? And we don't know what their response was. We do know the president said he did not say take them out. But on face value, for him to ask to the person, why do we need more in a conversation about immigration, is not in itself racist. But the other comment, if they were said about the countries or about the countries' governments or how they were run, it's unfortunate. And like others have said, it's not helpful. And we've seen what this has done. So instead of talking about getting closer to a DACA fix or coming to the table or talking about the economy, we're talking about this comment. So clearly,
yeah, but that's what the president said, right? That's what the president said. We wouldn't be talking about it if he didn't call African nations shitholes and didn't ask why we need more Haitians. And I think it's important to pair it with what came after that, the second fragment of the thought. Why do we need more Haitians? We should get more people from Norway, right?
Well, I think it's important for us to not to say that all of this was in one stream of consciousness, in one statement. We don't know that. But what we do know is that the president did meet with the president of Norway the day before, so that Norway was top of mind. And when you meet with a world leader, you go through all of the data, all of the statistics, the crime rate, the GDP, their economies, and all of those things. So I think that's why Norway was top of mind, because he had just met with the Norwegian president.
Okay.
So I think that's important to also note. But I'm not saying that. I think we should just keep that in mind.
So let me play something for you from this is Isaac Newton Ferris Jr., Dr. King's nephew, who was at the event yesterday at the White House for Martin Luther King his weekend. He was certainly. Let's just play the soundbite and talk about it afterwards. What he said about the president.
Sure.
I don't think that President Trump is a racist in the traditional sense as we know in this country. I think President Trump is racially ignorant or racially uninformed. But I don't think that he's a racist in the traditional sense.
That doesn't really sound like an endorsement of the president. What's your reaction to that?
Well, first of all, I was at that event yesterday. I've known Isaac for about a decade, and I think he's a great person because he actually reaches out and wanted to have the president involved and was with the president in Atlanta for the signing. I think he was here in Washington, D.C., and actually wanted to have the chairwoman of the Republican National Committee come to Atlanta but couldn't get a hold of her. So he is the one who is a positive force in trying to reach out to not only this administration,
but he did
the same with the Bush administration, too. So to Isaac's point, look, I agree with him in saying that the president is not a racist because he's not a racist.
But do you believe with the second half of that he is racially ignorant?
And the second half of that, I think the president is understanding now that he's having to deal with issues that he's never had to deal with before and deal with a lot
of... He's understanding now. He should have understood that before he said, I'm running for president of the United States, right?
Well, listen, no president comes in here knowing every single thing. No president comes in having an understanding of every simple...
What's the evidence that he now understands that? Is the evidence that he called African nations shithole countries or that maybe we don't need more Haitians? When you say now he's understanding that he's going to deal with a lot of issues, this is a president who's been on the job for 11 months now. How long do you need to not be in office, but be alive to know that the 54 nations of Africa are not shitholes?
Well, I'll challenge you there. We don't know if there were specific countries named and he responded about specific countries.
Are there specific shitholes in Africa? What I'm saying is,
if you talk about you can have an intellectual conversation without being a racist, comparing Nigeria, like your other guest did, and talking about the economy there, talk about the type of people who come here from Nigeria, what they contribute to this nation, their education, how much more they make than white Americans, like she said, $10,000 more.
And you can compare
them to other African countries that
aren't
doing so well.
But in what context do you call one of them a shithole?
I'm not here to defend that comment. I would not have used that comment. Many people can say and not be deemed racist or not being against the president, saying sometimes he says things or tweets things that aren't politically correct. Got it. Does not make him a racist. And you can have that intellectual conversation. And we should have that conversation.
So let me ask you this. You think that calling African countries shitholes is just politically incorrect?
I'm saying that the president at times makes politically incorrect statements. I would not have used that language to describe certain African nations. If that's what was said.
You wouldn't have used it. It was wrong for the president to use it. Can you at least go that far?
I don't think that I would have used it. And I think
Paris,
the president...
I don't know that this is asking too much to ask you, is it wrong for the president of the United States? And put aside your personal affinity for the man...
Let me ask you
about your respect for the office.
Is it wrong for
the president of the United States to call the 54 nations of an entire continent shitholes? That's a simple question.
I understand what you're trying to get me to do, but the notion that the president said that about all 54 nations is not true, and that would be wrong. Because as the other commentator talked about Nigeria and the quality of the people that are coming here from Nigeria and what they contribute, that does not apply. So I don't think he was talking about them. So no, I don't think it was right to say that use that phrase. But I do think it is perfectly okay and not racist to have an intellectual conversation when you're talking about immigration and making comparisons to say. There are differences between one country and another country, one city in America and another city in America. The recovery in Mississippi versus the recovery in New Orleans based upon after Hurricane Katrina. You can do that and not be a racist. But I will say I would not have used it. And I don't think if the president, seeing how this has panned out, would have used that because what I was saying about what he's learning how to do and understanding is that as president, you can't say certain things.
Yes.
And he's learning that because this is a new thing for him. And every president does
this. Right.
Every president has it. But to say
Paris,
he's a racist is wrong.
Thank you so much.
Business that attempts to keep black people from renting from you, If you are reported to say that you don't want black people counting your money, if you say someone can't judge your case because they're Mexican, if your response to the first black president is that they weren't born in this country, if that's the essence of your entire political identity, you might be a white supremacist.
Welcome to the whitest house. Slave souls haunt the halls when the light is out. They suck the blood of the poor and they wipe their mouth. The last gasp of a world that is dying out. Welcome to the whitest house, where every room is a tomb that they lie about. Where you can put your filthy feet on the finest couch, and for the right amount you can even buy it out. White power, white pride, white privilege. Whites maintain all their rights when whites pillage. White lies, white tears, and white feelings. White supremacy in the White House, the whitest building, ironically, in the place they call Chocolate City. Now all you see is a vanilla sky. That shit'll kill your vibe. They turn on the news for the realest lies. Damn, that shit is sadder than when children cry. 45, make you wanna grab the 45. Nazis, what is this, 1945? Progressive white, so horrified. Black people, like we tried to tell y'all, you ignore the signs. Trudeau, I need a visa, please order mine. Or my Chicano piece can sneak me through the borderline. That slogan on that red hat was so popular. Who knew it meant marching with torches and waving swastikas? Welcome to the whitest house. Slave souls haunt the halls when the light is out. They suck the blood of the poor and don't wipe their mouth. The last gas of a world that is dying out. Welcome to the whitest house, where every room is a tomb that they lie about. Where you can put your filthy feet on the finest couch, and for the right amount you can even buy it out. When the anthem plays, I'ma sit next to Colin Kaepernick and Marshawn Lynch. Shout out to all my Africans, descendants of those victims of slave trafficking. The men that captured them, they built statues, the champion. And what religion were they practicing? Burning crosses in the Oval Office, while Emma Rosa and Ben Carson defend racists in the same place Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. White minds with black faces, a nation indoctrinated in hatred and need of an operation. Approval rating less than one third of the population, who took off their hoods so their identity's not mistaken. America's greatness, we not debating. Her history of murder and raping, we not erasing. Kill Mexicans, kill blacks, and kill natives, cause a real American can only be Caucasian.
Hey yo, what's up y'all? This is DJ Spooky, that Subliminal Kid, giving y'all a wild style shout out. You're rolling with a podcast that's licensed under the Creative Commons license. So I just want to say, check it, download it, remix it, transform it. This is all about the Wild Style remix. So, once again, Creative Commons, y'all. DJ Spooky, Wild Styles in your area. Subliminal Minded.
Yo, what's up? My name is Jasiri X, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really responding to the call, man, of my sister Rosa Clemente, you know what I'm saying? For Men in Hip Hop, really stand up and say, like, rape under no circumstances is acceptable. You know what I'm saying? Rape shouldn't be rapped about. It should be supported. You know what I'm saying? And I'm really feeling like, you know, especially after Rick Ross came out today and said what he said, you know, he didn't use the word rape, but he described a scenario in which, you know, he put something in a woman's drink and had sex with her and she didn't consent. If you have sex with a woman and she didn't consent, that's rape. And we have to say no to rape. And beyond Rick Ross, whether it's Fox News or their viewers attacking Zelina Maxwell for asking men to stop raping women, whether it's Hollywood, you know, perpetuating, you know, this rape culture, you know, it's got to stop. It's really, you know, we got to take personal responsibility as men. My name is Jasiri X. This is One Hood.
Hi, Tiffany. Thank you for waiting on hold. Welcome. You're on Sirius XM Insight.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
What's on your mind?
I am the minority of this radio station today. I actually am a Trump supporter. I will say that my political knowledge is not very high.
Makes sense.
Mainly because it's so negative. I just try to stay...
Yeah, and Donald Trump has taken advantage of that. But go on, please. Tell me why. What was it about him on a policy level that made you want to vote for him?
He wasn't Hillary Clinton.
I knew you were going to say that.
Again, Tiffany. But again, I understand personality level. But I'm asking on a policy level, what was he going to do as president that made you think that he'd be better for the country and for your family than Secretary Clinton?
Honestly, I am a woman, so obviously people think that I'm all, you know, pro-feminism, and I am not. I'm not for that necessarily.
Makes
and not
sense.
In a negative way.
Mm-hmm.
Just in a Christian way, and I'm trying to...
Are you a Christian, Tiffany?
I absolutely am, and very proud.
May I ask a question? I'm a big fan of Jesus. May I, respectfully...
Me too.
Okay, because here's what I struggle with, Tiffany, and I say this with respect and love. I can't think of a single teaching of Christ that Donald Trump has fought for on a policy or personal level. To me, it is an absolute repudiation of the Sermon on the Mount, and there is nothing Jesus taught in the New Testament that I have not seen Donald Trump reject publicly. Why is a Christian, based on the teachings of Jesus, why as a follower of Jesus would you support a guy who, rather than stand up for the marginalized, as Christ does, consistently demonizes people at the lowest levels and the margins of society, someone who, instead of helping the struggling, cuts taxes for the wealthy, someone who allows more pollution in the air and water? I really struggle with how a Christian who follows the teachings of Christ goes for Trump. Please help me understand.
Well, the first thing that came to my mind is that Christians believe in forgiveness. So, like, when Obama was president, he wasn't my favorite. I had a son who was born with a cleft lip and palate, so he had a pre-existing condition. So mm-hmm. he took my insurance away. But
Barack Obama made health insurers not be able to deny coverage for that. And now you might not know
right.
this, but Jeff Sessions is going to court to try to make pre-existing conditions come back for insurance companies.
Let me backtrack that a little bit. You're right. I do. The pre-existing conditions for my son are covered. You're correct. And that's been a huge blessing for us when we need to get new insurance. However, I pay almost double in insurance that I do in my mortgage a month, and my husband and I work our tails off. But that's not to answer your question back to Jesus.
But by that same token, I'm with you. I'm not a fan of insurance companies. I wish we had single payer, the same insurance all of our allies have. Do you support having a national health insurance like Bernie Sanders talked about, like England and Germany and France and Japan and all of our allies enjoy, where no one can ever go bankrupt over healthcare costs? Would you support that?
Absolutely not. I absolutely don't.
What do you support? You support insurance companies still being able to charge you?
I want to go back to the Jesus question first.
Sure, do it.
Because that's one important, and I want to help you understand that.
Okay.
Me as a Christian, I did not support the things that Obama was doing as a Christian.
Which things?
But as a follower...
I'm sorry, which teachings of Christ did Obama go against?
I am limited political knowledge. I'm just calling as a Trump supporter.
Okay, so then let's get to the question. What teachings of Christ has Donald Trump acted on and tried to stand for on a policy level
that
or a
Obama
personal
didn't.
Level that Obama didn't? Please tell me something he's done that justifies a Christian thinking he's the Christian option.
Well, I think he's a Christian option because he always uses God's name.
He talks a good game, yeah, but Christ warns us in Matthew 6:5 not to trust the guys in public.
Every politician talks a good game. I wouldn't say that Donald Trump is the only politician who talks a good game.
Okay, but Donald Trump is someone...
People don't like Trump because he actually follows through on what he told us he was going to do. So I think as a Republican, I voted for him because he, to me, seemed like the average Joe. Like, he was the guy...
Okay, but I'm asking you about the teachings of Christ. What Jesus teaching has he ever stood up for and fought for? Because I can tell you many, many, many that he opposes and rejects on a policy and personal level. He can't stop lying. He's been publicly unfaithful to every wife he's ever had. He demonizes the poorest among us and the least among us and goes directly against Matthew 25. I just want you to tell me one thing. And it's not that he talks about God. That's not a teaching of Christ. I mean, he doesn't
Absolutely.
Go to church.
He's bringing Jesus back to America, which is important to Christians.
But how is he bringing Jesus back to America? Tell me one teaching of Jesus, because all I see is him rejecting the gospel teachings. I'm asking you, tell me one specific thing Christ said to do that this guy hasn't turned his back on. Can you give me one?
Okay. He loves people.
I'm getting a teaching
exactly
of Christ.
Christ
he doesn't he love people. He, but he doesn't.
Like
he,
Donald but he, Trump doesn't support.
How have you ever? We've never had a.
I don't.
But Tiffany, with respect, He calls people horrible names. He lies about people almost every day. He calls Mexicans rapists and criminals. He makes up demeaning nicknames for people he doesn't like. He's
separates
broken.
Families.
He's separating families. As a Christian, how do you tolerate him taking a child away from its mother?
He does separate families.
He does.
I mean, I have done a little research about
April's
immigration
okay.
thing, and it's, you do know that there are parents who are sending their kids in that aren't with their kids.
Yeah, that's not what we're talking about. These are children taken from their parents.
But they're generalizing it in a group.
A federal judge has ruled, has ordered him to return these children to his parents. I think that you're swallowing some Fox News propaganda to make you not... What's that?
I think they should go back to their parents because I work my tail off. I'm actually on my way to doing some... Because I work my tail off, and I don't want people coming into this country and taking... things away from me.
What is an illegal immigrant taken away from you? And who works harder in this society than undocumented immigrants? Who works harder for less money than undocumented workers?
I most definitely work hard. You have no idea.
I'd say, but
I work did my Christ off every day in order to afford health care.
Absolutely. And I'm not saying you don't, Tiffany, but when did an undocumented worker take away anything from you?
But why doesn't an undocumented worker need to be working harder than I do?
I'm saying they do because they can't make a living wage because they're paid below minimum wage in this country. I mean, those guys standing outside Home Depot looking for day labor work, they're not the ones who've raised your health care costs. That's the insurance company millionaires. You know
so
that, right?
Because people illegally came over here and are trying to find work, I should feel sorry for them that they're working hard and
no, but what I'm saying, because you're a Christian, I would expect a bit of empathy for people who risk their lives to try and give a better life to their children. And again, because you're a Christian, I would expect you to have some empathy when the state, when the big government, literally, and this is a Trump policy announced in April of this year, takes children from their parents with no plans to return them. They stole these children. Right now, they're having to do DNA testing because they never took anyone's names. They have no idea how to return 2,000 kids back to their parents, Tiffany. And morally, it's an atrocity. And I know you don't support that.
I'm fairly
she
certain
totally
that
supports
was in the Obama
it.
Administration.
No,
administration
no.
Well.
It was announced in April of this year that they were going to try to discourage border crossings by taking children away from parents, and they did it.
Is it because it's Trump that's saying it, or because...
It's because it's a terrible policy.
I have empathy for people. I absolutely do. I think it's awful what...
It's a terrible new policy. So, Tiffany, I'm still asking you for one teaching of Jesus that Donald Trump hasn't rejected, a specific teaching of Christ. Christ said, whatsoever you do to the least of my people.
He loves people. He loves people.
But who have we had as a president? But he hates people. He calls people these demeaning nicknames. Do you believe that the press are the enemy of the American people?
Well, I believe that.
Oh, absolutely.
You do believe that.
Social media are the downfall of the United States.
So him making fun of a handicapped of a disabled guy, that was okay with you. Him calling Mexicans rapists and criminals, that was okay with you. Him lying, he's told over 3,000 lies just since the inauguration. Bearing false witness is not a deal breaker for you. What promises has he kept?
I'm just saying that as a Christian, I believe that everybody sins.
I believe that too.
You're acting like you want him to be flawless. And
no, but they asked Donald Trump about this, and Donald Trump said, if I ever do anything wrong, I'll ask forgiveness. He denies that he ever sins. And you know he deliberately humiliated the mothers of his children, bringing his mistresses out in public with him. I don't think he's worth... I think you're a nice person, and he's not worthy of your defense.
I don't really like when people talk about Trump and how he's cheated on his...
I can tell you don't like that.
Or he was... Well, I'm just saying because I'm fairly certain that there was a Democrat president who did the exact same thing to his
wife. That doesn't make it okay.
Right.
That
doesn't make it okay in either case.
It doesn't make it okay. But if you're going to talk about Trump, you have to talk about...
But you're the one saying he's a great Christian, and I'm asking you to show me. We know he doesn't love his neighbor as himself. He doesn't. He puts people down. He antagonizes and insults people every day. He makes up demeaning nicknames for people. He loves picking on black women, and he loves picking on poor people. I'm waiting for you to show me. Like, where's the love? He loves...
I don't feel like he's picking on me.
Well,
I honestly feel like he is leading America how he feels is best because he came into a mess from 8 years ago.
But Barack Obama came into a mess from 8 years ago, and Barack Obama saved the economy. And we were losing 800,000 jobs a month when Barack Obama took office, and then he turned it around, much in the way Bill Clinton did a generation ago. Bill Clinton came in and left us with a surplus that George Bush gave away to rich people. I get the feeling you watch a lot of Fox News, Tiffany. Am I right?
I do not. You're absolutely incorrect.
Okay, where do you get your news from? That's okay. Thank you. Where do you get your news from?
The Patriot Channel, right?
No, I actually don't. I'm not even on Facebook. So if something becomes a hot topic, I try to do a little research about it. But honestly, I don't.
Okay,
want
Tiffany,
to know
really quick. Can I ask you a couple of really quick questions? Are you okay supporting a candidate who brags about sexually assaulting women?
I'm not. I mean, I am okay with it if he's asked for forgiveness. That's not my thing, though.
So, no, he didn't say for forgiveness. He said that it was locker room talk.
He doesn't have to ask me for forgiveness.
Right, but does he really do that, or was he lying? Which one? Because first he said, we heard him on tape say, grab him by the pussy, and then he said, it was just words, folks. So which one? Was he lying, or does he really do it?
I mean, I'm sure he probably said it. I'm not saying that he didn't say it, but what his conversation with God has nothing to do with me.
Does David Duke and the Klan's endorsement of him give you any concern?
I don't feel like he has any affiliation with the Klan.
No, I'm saying, does the Klan endorsing him and the Nazi Party endorsing him and David Duke endorsing him, does that give you any concern?
No.
That doesn't bother you. Okay. Do you find it at all troubling that he lied to you for months about his affair with Stormy Daniels?
Absolutely not.
That doesn't bother you that he lied to you about that?
No, because he can ask for forgiveness.
He didn't, but he doesn't ask for forgiveness.
I'm not saying that, but you're acting like his personal life has nothing to do with me. I have nothing to do with his personal life.
Right, but you're the one talking about you support him because he's a Christian, and I'm asking you to justify that.
I didn't say he was a Christian.
You said he was bringing Christ back to America, Tiffany.
He said he's bringing God back into America.
And you said he's bringing Jesus back to America. You have Jesus back
to
America.
Absolutely.
Okay, so would you lend him all the money you have if he promised to pay you back in 1 year with interest? Would you lend him every dime in your bank account if he promised to pay you back?
Probably, yes.
Okay, Tiffany, thank you for calling. I wish you good luck. Please feel free to call in any time, and we will always be respectful to you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. And I would recommend you watch a show called The Rachel Maddow Show. Just to challenge your own expectations, and you're always welcome to listen here, and I promise you can call in any time and tell me why I'm wrong, okay?
Okay.
Don't be afraid of other points of view. And think about this. How do you lose when Democrats win? Have a great day. And there you have it.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Machismo, the story of seven bandit Mexicans afraid of nothing but the shame of fear, fighting for their honor, faced with a wall of hate and death, struggling for their lives against the bigotry of a town and the woman who might betray them, against the 40 savage Americans who vowed to destroy them. Machismo, the guts to live like a man. Not since the Wild Bunch have you seen this kind of adventure. Don't miss it. Machismo.
Rated R.
Hi, friends. Have you ever said to yourself, I would like a career in radio announcing? If the answer to that is yes, then you're going about it in the wrong way. You should say it to someone else. What does it take to become a radio announcer? Well, actually, it takes many things. Do you own your own voice? Can you say six silly words without laughing and mean them? Do you have a lot of money? Well, if so, you qualify for enrollment in the Golden Voice Announcer School. I'll bet that you'd never guess from the sound of my voice that I am actually a 67-year-old deaf-mute woman, and that only 9 short years ago I heard a commercial just like this one and was inspired to climb out of my deathbed and enroll. As soon as my check for $13,000 was received, classes began. In addition to announcing, our voice training course will teach you to impersonate TV and motion picture stars like this. Howdy, partner, I'm John Wayne. Or... Howdy, partner. I'm Natalie Wood. Isn't that exciting? You can learn to do many other famous persons' voices, like Stanley L. Spiro, Carl Betts, Elena Verdugo, Ferrante and Teicher, or the all-time favorite, Don DeFore. Here's how to take advantage of this limited offer. Send $13,000 and any priceless heirloom to Golden Voice Announcer School, care of Phil's Barber Shop, Waco, Texas. And as a bonus, if you sign up immediately, you will receive an actual recording of Dick Clark, way back in 1956, stuttering and unable to pronounce the word nope. Here is an excerpt from that recording.
Okay, Dick, take 28 coming up. Try to relax now, will you, pal? The word is nope. N-O-P-E, nope. Right, all right, let's hit it.
No.
All right, Dick, that's it's good. It's coming. Take 29. All right, Dick. Yeah, that's lunch. Lunch 1 hour.
In addition, for those of you who happen to be listening to this message on a radio, here is a special offer. You will receive your first lesson free if you can identify this photograph of our mystery person. Now, here's a clue to help you out.
The first part's true. The second's a lie. The third remains the same. Put them together and take them apart, and then you will have my name.
How can we guarantee that after taking our course, you will have a perfect speaking voice? The answer is simple. Each of our students has an amplifying device surgically inserted in his throat. We call this device our Big Boy Voice. And it is hardly noticeable because externally it resembles half a bow tie. So don't delay. Send your check today and get in on the high-paying action as a famous radio personality. And remember our slogan, if it weren't for your mouth, you'd be talking out of your nose.
I like going to cons. I like meeting my fans. I like meeting other writers and podcasters. And I like getting a chance to meet the authors I admire, and even the occasional celebrity. You know what else I like? I like being around people, women especially, who act flirty, dress sexy, and don't mind being looked at once in a while. I'm a married man, but you know, when I stop looking, it'll be time to bury me. But you know what? Some of you fuckers are spoiling it for the rest of us. When you assholes, and you know who you are, go putting your hands where they don't belong, you're spoiling it. I've seen you fuckers. I've heard the stories. Brushing up against someone in the hall. Copping a feel when you think you can get away with it. Treating a human being like a sex toy because you think your desires and a bit of skin give you the right to grope anyone you like. You're spoiling it for the rest of us. Because you know what happens when someone gets treated that way? They retreat. They treat anyone who even looks at them as if they're committing a crime. They distrust. They dress down, trading short skirts and low necklines for loose t-shirts and sweatpants. They scorn, and eventually they stop coming to cons at all. And then all of us pay the price because you couldn't keep your filthy paws to yourself. So get this, you goddamn dirty ape. Next time I see this happening, I'm calling you on your shit. You are going to be the one who gets humiliated. You are going to be the one sticking your tail between your legs. You are going to be the one that's sorry you came to the con. And don't think that just because you're not a man, or that your target isn't a woman, that I won't step in just as hard, because I will, motherfucker. And it goes just the same outside the con, too. Doesn't matter where I see you, I will stop you. And I'm not the only one who's going to be keeping my eye out, either. You can fucking count on it.
Now that America has a black president, is this proof that racism is a thing of the past?
Well, I think white men were 100% of the people that wrote the Constitution, 100% of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, 100% of the people who died at Gettysburg and Vicksburg, probably close to 100% of the people who died at Normandy. This has been a country built basically by white folks in this country who were 90% of the entire nation. I think they ought to do. They ought to defend the legitimate rights of white working class folks who are the victims of discrimination.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal media. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
The top of the hour on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn presents
It Sucks to Be White
with comedian Tara Devlin from RepublicanDirtyTricks.com and comedian Sherry D. Sutton. In Switzerland.
Where we have no real microphone technology.
Right, so we apologize. And
please, do the best you can.
Support Progressive Voices, and maybe we'll one day be in a studio.
Maybe we'll get two brothers that will give us some money.
Right, really. I mean, this whole elections is so disgusting. Do you know what you know who I can't stand the most? Ted Cruz is the worst.
Oh, number one. Yeah, he's frightening.
Everything about him is so vile. Even his daughter. Did you see his daughter like, flicking at him? She hates him, too. But you know how children are. They can read people. I love that his roommate from college, who's actually a screenwriter now, who wrote The Hangover, he says that it's his hatred for Ted Cruz isn't political. That if he agreed with Ted Cruz on 100% of his politics, he'd hate him about 1% less.
That's hilarious.
Google Ted Cruz's college roommate. It's really funny. His religiosity, he loves to torture, but he is so into Jesus. But he definitely has the racist, redneck, white trash vote locked up, right?
I need to clarify something for you, because you're kind of talking about my people, and you've lumped them into two things, and there's a difference between redneck and white trash.
Well, you have to explain, Sherry. Being from the South, you need to tell me these things.
I will. Because, see, rednecks aren't necessarily racist bigots, but white trash people are. We can trace that all the way back to the Bible. You want to get some Christian white trash stories? The Bible's got, I'll give you one of them, all right? It's in Genesis, I believe, in like chapter 19. And this is right after Sodom and Gomorrah was burnt down, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Lot escaped with his two daughters, because his wife got turned into a pillar of salt. And they escaped Sodom and Gomorrah. They're living in a cave, and Lot's asleep. And the oldest daughter says to her younger sister, "Our father is old, and there is no man to lie with us as is custom all over the earth. Let's get our father drunk with wine, and then lie with him to preserve our family line through our father. Because I ain't screwing no foreigner, that's a sin."
Right. That would be disgusting.
That's white trash. That's white trash. See, people think that it was Harriet Beecher Stowe, the author, you know, of Uncle Tom's Cabin, that kind of clarified what white trash was for, because she said not only did slavery, like, produce degraded, miserable slaves, but it also produced poor whites who were even more degraded and miserable.
Mm.
And that both blacks and whites looked down on poor white trash. And I cannot imagine how degraded you'd have to be to feel worse off than a slave.
Really?
That's got to be something. I mean, because I watched the entire miniseries of Roots in the 1970s,
mm-hmm.
and I don't ever remember a moment when Kunta Kinte looked over at Miss Kizzy and was like, "Oh, Miss Kizzy, life sure is hot. I got beat by massa today. Now we eating cornbread and chitlins for the 7th time this week. But thank the Lordy, we ain't as bad off as them crackers down the road." See, I'll give it to you really quickly, okay? Because you know Jeff Foxworthy pretty much allowed us to get an understanding of what a redneck is. And that's
mm-hmm.
the first cousin of white trash, right? But they're not the same. And I know it's confusing for people like you Yankees when you see us all gathered at a NASCAR race or a monster truck pool.
True.
Right? It's hard to tell the difference. We got the same trashy clothes. We got 1980s hairstyles. And we all have movable living quarters. I'm going to shed a little bit of light on you about the group commonly referred to as white trash, with some little humor that I call hilarious and terrifying. I just like to call that hilarifying. Now I'm going to do my own Foxworthy style humor for you, just so you and the listeners can get a better understanding.
Okay.
Right? Redneck, if you've ever shot someone. White trash, if you've ever shot someone in your own family. Redneck, usually reads trashy tabloid magazines. White trash? Can't. Redneck wears a Confederate flag because his great-great-grandpappy fought in the Civil War. White trash wears a Confederate flag because we hate black people.
Well, that clears it up.
That's my family. Those are the people. Like, see, my family are mostly rednecks that married into white trash. They think rednecks are uppity and snooty.
Well, that's like the southern version of Modern Family, right?
Her mother-in-law gave her a bag of weed as a wedding gift.
And these are all true stories, too.
See, here's the thing. Now, I did a show, right, called Taking Out the White Trash, but I got a theater critic who reviewed me. His name is Colin McLean, and he gave the review, and I ended up with this white supremacy group called Stormfront, who got very angry about the fact that I had referred to myself as white trash, and they didn't like Colin for agreeing with me. Actually, I didn't like Colin for agreeing with me, but that's totally different. And the thing is, Taryn, I guess I'll end it with this, is that these are the people that are out there getting behind these candidates. This is why we've got to stay progressive. So listen, this has been Sherry D. Sutton and Tara Devlin for It Sucks to Be Right. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and keep listening for more on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
We stick together, we win.
These are Manfred and Leo Friedman. They are my first cousins. Not distant relatives, first cousin. A few months after this picture was taken, 75 years ago, the Nazis put them on a train and then exterminated them, like vermin. They might have been saved if the U.S. had approved their parents' application to emigrate, but it didn't, because Americans thought Jews were shifty and dangerous. For some people in the White House, the Holocaust exists only in the history books. For the Jewish people, it is a collective national trauma. But along with Manfred and Leo and their parents, the Nazis murdered my grandparents, my aunts, my uncles, my cousins, and countless other relatives. So for me, and for many other Jews, the Holocaust is still very, very personal, each and every day. Which is why I felt that, in recent days, the White House bashed my head in 3 times in a row. First, when President Trump's ban on Muslims brought back painful family memories of America's locked gates. Second, because the Holocaust is first and foremost about Jews. Manfred and Leo, along with 6 million others, were murdered because they were Jews, but the White House erased Jews from its Holocaust Day statement. And third, because White House spokesman Sean Spicer had the chutzpah to describe complaints about the omission as pathetic nitpicking and to proclaim that Trump had gone out of his way to mark Holocaust Day. In other words, the Jews should be grateful and shut their mouths. But I'll tell him what's truly pathetic. One, that the White House, hopefully out of ignorance, tried to minimize the centrality of Jews in the Holocaust, like some Holocaust deniers. Two, that its excuse for doing so is a perverse kind of political correctness of trying to be, and I quote, incredibly inclusive. Three, that rather than apologize or admit a mistake, the president's automatic response is attack, attack, attack. Four, that the administration still can't comprehend how much it hurts so many Jews, especially in America. And five, that Trump believes that support for Israeli policies or that a Jew was involved in writing the statement makes everything better. But I'll tell you what's really pathetic. That Israel didn't say a word. That Prime Minister Netanyahu and his ministers would have torn Obama apart if he dared do something similar, gave in to political expediency, cowardice, and just plain indifference. That was truly pathetic and hurtful and very, very personal.
The American Spirit March.
From every area liberated by the armies of the United Nations, new evidence is reaching us of crimes and atrocities committed by the Nazis. A great many Germans know about these crimes. Those who do not know because they do not want to know. They do not ask questions because they are afraid of the answers. They fear the knowledge of what they have tolerated. But the civilized world has means to differentiate between criminals and their victims. These means are deeds. Men will have to prove by deeds where they stood, and where they stand. Mere words will not be believed by a world that has witnessed the crimes which the Nazis have committed.
I was a young assistant to a judge at the tribunal in Berlin. And on the 1st of April 1933, the famous boycott day, when Hitler sent the SS and the SA in the streets, and they watched every Jewish shop, every office of a Jewish lawyer, every office of a Jewish doctor. They were posted there, and there were demonstrations in the streets. On that day, I was suspended in my official position. As a matter of fact, my family, which consisted of five people, with the exception of my mother, everybody was thrown out or suspended. My father was a lawyer, he was suspended as a lawyer. My elder sister was a teacher at the college, was suspended as a teacher at the college. I was an assistant to a judge, I was suspended as an assistant to the judge. My younger sister was in school and was thrown out from the school. If that happens to a family, you understand that something very dramatic is developed.
Some people just left everything, business, apartment, and they tried to get out. Some people were struggling, and some people believed, a lot of them, there are going to be a change. It's going to be different. Things will be modified, but then what we were told from Nazis, if you think that there's going to be any change for the better, forget it. It's going to be the change for worse.
They came thousands and thousands to the American consulate. They came to every country which was a little bit free. They came running and said, give me a visa, give me a visa.
I should have taken more in, I could have saved thousands of lives, but they didn't open the door for them. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. I'm glad to be here, and I'm thankful I'm here.
Sure.
But none of my family came out because America didn't open the doors for us.
President Roosevelt was interested in trying to do something for the refugees. And when the Germans created the Anschluss, he felt there was an opportunity to tell the world that we were going to try to do something for the victims of the Nazi persecution.
There was an Evian conference which Roosevelt called. It was one of the most tragic experiences of my long life. I was there. There was a Jewish delegation of three people, Golda Meir, I, and Dr. Weizmann. I was the main spokesman. There were about 20 governments. There were all the great churches. There were all the international organizations. Not one of them was ready to take in 1,000 Jews.
Did you think Roosevelt was sincere?
Well, I don't know. I certainly thought that he was sincere. But he was probably incapable to make any major gesture. And if America couldn't make such a gesture, you couldn't expect it from the other countries.
Well, Robert Pell was at the Evian conference, which occurred in the late 30s in France, where they were discussing this question of the maltreatment of the Jews in Germany and what could be done about it. And partly perhaps as a result of that conference, Robert took the lead in establishing the Jewish settlement in the Dominican Republic.
The Dominican Republic, about the size of Holland and Belgium, with a population of about 1.5 million, has opened its heart to the homeless people of a troubled Europe. Spokesman for the U.S. State Department was the Honorable Robert T. Pell.
The government of the United States of America is proud to be associated in a tribute to the Dominican people whose generous attitude has made possible settlement of many hundreds of European refugees on this hospitable soil.
Trujillo was concerned about correcting the balance in his population between whites and blacks. And he knew all the refugees would be white.
He offered 100,000 Jews to come into San Domingo, but this was, of course, a gesture which was to be foreseen, would not have been picked up because the people were not the infrastructure for really large settlements in this country, and a few thousand Jews came to socialize, and their life was saved. I'm not saying anything about the importance of even such a gesture.
The Zionists were ideologically, which means emotionally, psychologically, unprepared for such an emergency of having to rescue not individuals, not small groups, not pioneers, but to rescue hundreds of thousands, millions of people. They were just not prepared. And actually, they used to say, rescue is not our business.
SASUA, new world shelter for refugees. SASUA, haven in the Caribbean.
Well, I went to Shanghai.
Right, now how come you had to go to Shanghai?
The Americans didn't let me come in, as simple as that. It just didn't work very well. It was very difficult to immigrate here. My affidavit was gone. I waited a year. Shanghai had the doors open, so I took the best chance to get out.
I received an affidavit in 1938, and then I discovered I had not registered with the American consulate. Now, the registration numbers were very high because there was only a certain quota. So there was no chance for me to wait because my number didn't come until 1941. In the meantime, in 1939, I went to England on a domestic permit.
London. Scenes in this picture are taken from Brunsbury Park, but similar ones are taking place in many parts of the country. The children are part of the Jewish refugee influx, which is providing the world with such a ticklish problem. Not all of them know where their parents are. They write letters, which will in many cases never be delivered. But meanwhile, these arrangements for the kiddies keep them fed and as happy as possible under circumstances which all people of understanding and sympathy must surely deplore.
There should have been a crisis, but there wasn't enough passion in the United States to have the refugees come in. It was horrible. Ship came from Hamburg, I believe it was, to Cuba. The Cubans wouldn't let them in. They came up to America. America wouldn't let them in. And the ship was sent back to Hamburg for the people there to be burnt. The horrible thought is that at the time of the Holocaust in Europe, the Western European nations and the United States and many other nations would not change their immigration laws one jot, one iota. And what Hitler was seeking to do, certainly in the beginning stages, was not to kill the Jews, but to have them removed from Germany. But nobody would accept them.
I think basically it was an economic fear of numbers. After all, how many could you admit, or would you admit? The number pressing for admission is very high. Roosevelt was thinking of the problem as in terms of 10 million.
And what were the long-range plans?
Well, I'm not sure that there were any.
Roosevelt may have wanted to increase the quota, but there would have been great resistance in the Congress. And he wasn't courageous enough on this issue to fight the Congress.
Why not?
Because a president has to take care of public opinion. Why not? If you have a majority of Congress against you, you can't put things through.
There were a number of prominent Jewish congressmen, like Saul Bloom, of the West Side of New York. He never raised his voice in support of efforts for refugees.
The Zionists didn't like Jews per se. They considered the masses of the Jews, the millions of the Jews, as parasites, as unproductive elements, as people who are behaving in embarrassing ways. They wanted a new type of Jews. Weizmann said that only a minority, only a remnant can be saved. The others, 4 million, he said, are like dust, and they will be spread by the cruel winds of history, and there is nothing one can do about it. We can only sympathize.
You know, the United Nations, at that time League of Nations, established a High Commission for German Refugees. McDonald was a High Commissioner, was later the first American ambassador in Israel, a good friend of mine. I was a member of the executive board. They couldn't get any country to admit more than a few hundred Jews in the best case, and all they did was always pressure the Jewish agency to admit more German Jews to Palestine, because we had a quota and we had to distribute to various countries.
We planned an organized exodus to Palestine, illegal from the point of view of the British. We used to issue every year what they used to call a schedule, a number of certificates for immigrants. The number was very limited. And then they decided to stop immigration altogether, and this was on the very eve of the outbreak of the war, the famous white paper in 1939.
On September the 1st, 1939, the Nazi army smashed into Poland.
They told us in advance. Hitler made a number of speeches, and Göring made speeches, and Goebbels made speeches. On the 30th of January, the day of what they called the Machtergreifung, when they took power, they announced at several of these speeches, if this war will end, it will not end with the defeat of the German people, but it will be the end of the Jewish race in Europe. When the German armies marched in, thousands of Jews, thousands of non-Jews were individually killed, were shot, this is all documented in, was documented in white books and yellow books and other publications by the Allies.
We had to emphasize that there is a Jewish war problem, and we initiated the program to create a Jewish army. We didn't succeed because we were attacked.
Who attacked?
All the Jewish organizations.
On April 9th, 1940, the leaders of Nazi Germany shifted their war machine into high gear. They overran into Denmark. They smashed into Norway. On May the 10th, 1940, they blitzed into Holland and Belgium.
During the retreat in June 1940, the Germans were all around our unit. We were all volunteers in the French army of either German or Italian origin, in fact, nationality. We had still German and Italian papers. We were not naturalized. So in case we were going to be taken prisoners by the Germans, we would have been shot as deserters. So we prevailed upon our lieutenant to issue us identities in a French identities that we made up overnight. Literally during one night, we sat together and hammered out on a typewriter this little document here, which is an excerpt of the military passbook that has been lost during the campaign, and there we entered then these fictitious nationalities. I then was able to move about in unoccupied France with relative freedom, And that was one part, I think, of the attraction that I held also for Varian Fry, because most people didn't have that kind of, did not have that kind of a perfect false identity.
The idea was to save as many of the outstanding leaders, many political, others economic or scientific, but men who really had a valuable contribution to make to the world, to save as many of those as possible.
First we worked just out of the hotel room of Fry's, but very soon it became obvious that we had to get an office, and we got an office in somewhere downtown Marseille, and word spread like wildfire and so on, and very soon there were lines forming outside the street and for a block long. I was lucky because I was in the French army, you know, I had volunteered for the French army, so I was not in a camp during that period, but many were in camps, and we're still in camps. We tried, some of the more prominent people, we had tried to get out of camps, including Feuchtwanger, for instance, and others. Our job was precisely that was one of the more disagreeable jobs, was to pick and choose among these many people who came and asked for some help.
I think that was responsible for solving the problem for at least 1,500 people.
Perhaps one tragic aspect of the story is that precisely that there was a great deal was accomplished, and we were all very proud of what we accomplished, and perhaps everybody was so proud that they forgot about all the others. Looking back on the episode, that is perhaps, to some extent at least, the price that we paid for getting out these few.
There has been a quota system. Without quota, you couldn't come in, except you had a senator on pay at least $500, he get you in. To that time, I know it. I can prove it.
You know, when I came 1940 to America, I lived before in Geneva, I was representing the Jewish Agency for Palestine in America. I was the only member of the executive. And I was supposed to represent them, especially in Washington. So I brought my family over to New York, where I had an apartment, and I established an office in Washington, where I had also an apartment. 3 days a week I spent in Washington, and 4 days a week with my family. And I established very close relations, especially through the help of Stephen Weiss. Now, I spent every week 1 or 2 days in the State Department. Most of them, I wouldn't say were anti-Semites, but great bureaucrats, who were dead against increasing the quota.
They were afraid that the refugees would be fifth columnists, in other words, spies.
No longer can the Nazis and fascists in this country masquerade as patriots or the communists as liberals. For us, there can be but one policy: keep America out of Europe and Europe out of America.
I spoke to Roosevelt about it, and others spoke to Roosevelt about it, but he said, get the Congress a majority, then I'll do it gladly.
And what did Wise say to that? Could he get a majority?
No.
Why not?
Because the whole state of mind of America was at that time isolationist and anti-war and anti-refugees, bureaucratic. We don't want to have these European Jews.
Today's threat to our national security is not a matter of military weapons alone. We know of new methods of attack. The Trojan horse, the fifth column, that betrays a nation unprepared for treachery. Spies, saboteurs, and traitors are the actors in this new strategy. These dividing forces are undiluted poison. They must not be allowed to spread in the new world as they have in the old.
I only recall one refugee whom the President's Advisory Committee got in from Czechoslovakia. And when the war was over and he returned to Czechoslovakia, he turned out to be a communist. In other words, he would have been what they called a fifth columnist.
On June the 22nd, 1941, the success crazy Nazis took their longest step toward world conquest. Without any declaration of war, they blitzed into Russia.
And I hate to say this, President Roosevelt, and I say this despite the fact that I still deem him a great president, and I don't want to denigrate him. Nonetheless, he felt that trying to help the Jews at that time and thereafter would make him subject to the charge of Jew deal.
The evil mastermind of aggression is forced into the open. The world's number one arsonist and killer declares the war on the United States, and his stooges applaud. The president bought the first defense bond and set an early example for us all. Let's get behind our army, our navy, and our president.
Fellow Americans, I ask you to demonstrate again your faith in America.
For us, that was the great alternative. And if we didn't have faith in that alternative, in what could we have faith? I had, even in the war years, I had a photo of Roosevelt, a picture of him, which the American consul gave me for years. I had it on my wall.
The Allied governments, Great Britain, and later when the United States entered the war, they ignored this war aim of the Nazis, and they tried by every means possible, consistently, persistently, to act as if the Jews were not singled out as a special category for destruction.
Goebbels says, we don't want the Jews. Apparently the nations don't want the Jews. Let's kill the Jews. Let's make Germany Judenrein.
The first bit of information was received as early as August of 1942 from the Secretary of the World Jewish Congress in Switzerland, who reported that Hitler had under consideration a plan to exterminate all Jews in German-controlled Europe.
The man who had brought the message was a very reliable man, and he had brought other messages before who had proved absolutely accurate. So I said to the Americans and to the British, please inform your government of this message. Please verify this message through your own secret services. After all, you have secret services, I do not have it. And number three, please give the following message to Dr. Stephen Weiss.
And by November of 42, sufficient information had been received that Sumner Wells authorized the Jewish organizations to make this public.
The first story that 2 million Jews were massacred, I read one horrible, probably the most horrible morning of my life in Washington in November of 1942, and buried in the 8th or 10th page of the Washington Post. I remember it was on the left side of the page, on the little story, maybe the headline of about 3-4 inches, saying Rabbi Weiss says 2 million Jews slain. And this newspaper story changed my life, because I instinctively reacted. I said, this is the overwhelming thing that happening in the world today that's dominating my life. In fact, I couldn't go on with what I was doing. I was the director of a committee for a Jewish army, which was, after all, very close to these issues. And I couldn't go on and keep an appointment that day with a congressman to talk about committee for a Jewish army, because it seemed futile.
I don't know whether you ever met Weizsäcker, seen him, wonderful human being. He was deeply concerned. And you read some of the letters written during that period, you would see he wrote a letter to Justice Frankfurter, he wrote a letter to one of his friends who was a Protestant minister, where he writes he cannot sleep, he cannot forget, he has a terrible news and he doesn't know what to do.
If Rabbi Weiss, when he had that press conference the day before about which I read in the paper, would have fainted right there, or would have torn his clothes, and would have called a meeting the next day of all the leadership of the Jews, you know, and said, what are we going to do, and declare the real emergency? You know, I have no doubt they would have convinced the American government that it has to become a task of America's war aim. One of America's war aims would be to counter this German war aim of killing the Jews, and becomes America's purpose to save the Jews. I don't think this was a difficult notion to put across. But he didn't do that. He just said some very innocuous words, reacted normally, and then everybody went on business as usual. Therefore, without justifying and condoning Roosevelt, I must start by saying that in all decency, human decency, one has to ask, what did the Jewish leaders do to shake Roosevelt?
My friend Stephen Weiss was in opposition to the so-called establishment, which was mostly composed of rich and influential Jews, especially the American Jewish Committee, the American Joint Distribution Committee and others. Weiss was always a fighter for democracy in Jewish life, established the American Jewish Congress. He really established the world, he got me to establish the World Jewish Congress, but he had personally very good contacts in Washington.
The first thing I did is run to see Assistant Secretary of State Adolf Burley. It was from a conference with him that Weiss came out when he announced the massacre, which I saw in the paper. And he confirmed this to me. As a matter of fact, he even said that they had been urging Weiss to announce it a few weeks earlier. And I said, what are you going to do about it? Which I think, Larry, is a normal human reaction. I mean, when you hear of a thing like this, what are you going to do? And he says, what can we do? I say, surely there's something you can do. You know, I said, I don't know what I can do. I'm telling you, Mr. Secretary, I'm going to do something. I mean, I'm going to do everything I can. I mean, from now on, that's all I'm going to do, is try and save the Jews. You know, and then, you know, this and that, and I felt, if I want to do something to save the Jews, I should make an enemy of an Assistant Secretary of State. So I apologized, and I thanked him for his kindness and so forth, and I left. And I went straight to the first phone I could reach and called Marilyn in New York, who was my right-hand man in those days, and called a meeting that night of all the active people in the Committee for Jewish Army, and I made a speech there, which was published someplace in the Answer magazine, in which I said that from now on, we get up in the morning, we work all day and go to bed at night, only with one subject, and this is how to save the Jews. Now, if this would have been the attitude by 10% of the Jewish leadership in this country, many more, for every percent of Jewish leaders who would have thought so X percent of Jews would have been saved. But there weren't any.
Roosevelt was totally immersed in the war, and it was a tremendous thing, and he was deeply involved in it. The refugee problem tended to be regarded as a distraction from the war.
They knew the Jews were being killed, you know, but the grasp wasn't there. Now, the people who should have dramatized, shook up, awakened the otherwise busy, like Ben Hetz's ballad yesterday we looked at, the world is busy with other news. The otherwise unrealizing world leadership of what's going on should have been the Jewish leaders.
In reality, Hitler's propaganda had affected a great part of the free world too. Certainly during the first years of the war, everybody was anxious not to be accused that they were conducting the war of the Jews.
Who will say it's a Jewish war? Hitler? Hitler was screaming his propaganda, it's a Jewish war. So what? So the Allies didn't go to war for it? He was screaming it's a Jewish war because they went to war.
His real name was Bergson, but he was a nephew of the famous former chief rabbi of Israel, a great Jewish Talmudist and mystic, Rav Kook. And so he changed, he had a pen name, Hillel Cook. He established a committee and got senators to help him. Ben Hecht, they won over, and another group of intellectuals. And this, they were effective, and they did generally a very good job. They got the attention of American public opinion to the tragedy of the Jews.
I mean, wasn't he in the war? Wasn't it one war? Or what was Hitler's war against the Jews something outside? The Jews are outside of the pale of humanity. And this is precisely the core of the issue, Larry. That if you want to know what was the difference, is that we reacted on an assumption that the Jew is an equal human being and that he has an identity of his own, that the whole years prior to the extermination were possible because the Jews of England and France and America weren't interested in raising the sharpness, the question, what's happening to the Jews of Germany, because the unity of the Jews was phony.
Stephen Weiss tried his best. He had influence on Roosevelt, but not enough get him to oppose a majority in the Congress.
People were being drafted into the army, and people didn't think that they were drafted to go on rescue missions. They were drafted to fight the war.
Germany made it a war aim to exterminate the Jews. It was not a mob of screaming pogrom people keep raping women and killing children in a basement like in Russia, you know. It was a decided, planned governmental action in the middle of a war in which the Germans were using military personnel to do it. And therefore, only a war machine of the Allies could stop it. It was its duty to stop it. It was also its logic to stop it. I mean, in a war, whenever the enemy wants to take this hill, the other side prevents him from taking the hill. The very fact that the Germans wanted to do it was enough reason for the Allies to stop them from doing it, leave alone humanitarian concerns, and I don't slight humanitarian concerns.
Americans, fighting for their country while half a world away from it. Fighting for their country, and for more than their country. Fighting for an idea. The idea bigger than the country. Without the idea, the country might have remained only a wilderness. Without the idea might have remained only a dream.
Harold Ickes, the Secretary of Interior of the United States, was honorary chairman of the Emergency Committee to Save the Jewish People of Europe, which we eventually established in Washington. But you wouldn't give us one important Jew who joined our committee. One didn't rebel against the establishment and said, these people have an emergency committee to save the Jewish people of Europe. You know, we join.
To say that the Zionists or other Jewish organizations did nothing is incorrect. They have done hundreds of things, but they have done it first under pressure of their own constituencies, indicating our activities, asking them why don't they do it, and there was a spirit of near rebellion against the official leadership of the Zionists and the Jewish organizations.
They protested naturally, mass meetings, I spoke often in Madison Square Garden and so on, but with this normal methods of pressure, you don't influence Hitler.
When the Jewish agency, the world leadership of the World Zionist Organization, has called in the editors of the Hebrew press in Palestine when they first got the news and asked them voluntarily to put a censorship and not publish, and for months the Jews of Palestine didn't know there was a massacre when it was making all the front pages in the United States. And by the way, it took some Jews to put it on the front pages, and it was us, a few Palestinians who happened to be here. We got to nearly everybody. When we brought the pageant, We Shall Never Die, the Ben Hecht pageant, which was a very effective, a tremendous piece of propaganda. We did it in Madison Square Garden twice, and we brought it to Constitution Hall in Washington to an invited audience, which included hundreds of congressmen and senators, Supreme Court, four Supreme Court justices, Mrs. Roosevelt, most of the diplomatic corps, 90% of it, maybe more even, except the British embassy didn't come. And Roosevelt didn't come. And we jumped in trying to do whatever we can to mobilize governmental action.
And I fought them because they were very anti-government in America. They encouraged the opposition, but accusing Roosevelt and so on that they betrayed the Jewish people.
I was in those days as much a Zionist as Rabbi Weiss, I mean, at least to my knowledge. And it was actually in those days that I ceased being a Zionist because the fact that the Zionist leadership did not grasp the paramount responsibility of what's happening made me question the whole thing, and I arrived at the decision that the question of identity of the victims, that the Jewish unity didn't hold, that when 10,000 Jews a day were being killed in Europe, the Jews of Palestine and the Jews of America and the Jews of England were living their lives because you had a abstract notion of Jewish unity, which is important spiritually, which is important religiously, which is important in normal days, but we didn't withstand the test of war and extermination.
You were in the Warsaw Ghetto?
Yes. I was, yes, all the time.
And you said you were in the uprising?
Yes, I was in the uprising here.
And
but
that nobody would help?
No, nobody would help, no. It was the uprising. They was fighting like heroes, and they didn't have chance because they didn't have weapon. They was using the Molotov cocktails, they called that, and 300,000 Jews died.
These pictures, filmed by the underground and smuggled to their government in exile in London, are the first scenes to be shown of the Warsaw Uprising. The Germans systematically reduced the Warsaw Ghetto to rubble, exterminating uncounted thousands.
Every day we had radio with England, but no help. The help was only after the war. And of course, all my family I lost in Ghetto.
The only limit on Roosevelt's effort was what to do next. I think he tried everything that anyone could suggest to him.
The Bermuda Conference, an instrument of deception to give the impression, public opinion, that something is done.
They wanted simply a statement made that they were very sad about the massacres of the Jews, but they were also pleased that no positive action had been taken.
But Roosevelt would have gladly helped Jews and fought Hitler more politically and then militarily if the majority of public opinion in America wasn't dead against it, and he is a very smart politician, doesn't want necessarily to antagonize too much the majority.
We ran hundreds of ads, as you know, and we got responses from many non-Jews. I used to get livid, and I still get very annoyed when people tell me that you couldn't do anything because there was anti-Semitism in America. I mean, this is such ridiculous garbage, forgive me. I mean, That today people aren't ashamed. Today, 1978, people will give you this as an excuse, not realizing that in the whole history of the United States, one Jew was not killed because of anti-Semitism. In effect, what they are saying is because we were afraid that they won't admit us into the Harvard Club, they'll let 10,000 Jews a day in Europe get killed.
Congressman Sal Bloom had been selected as a delegate to both conferences. He was more or less one of those who always hung on the coattails of the State Department. He liked to attend the state dinners, and he liked the diplomacy that the State Department could accord him. When he went to Evian, when he went to Bermuda, he may have had pretty good declarations that he was going to do something worthwhile, but he came back empty-handed. He did nothing.
During the war, anyhow, very much couldn't be done except the bombing of the camps, and where the Americans were not, in my opinion, the one who prevented by the British. And I don't think America would have gone into a conflict with the British. It was difficult enough to maintain the solidarity of the Allies.
If the premise of our opponents was that everything is lost anyhow, the logical conclusion was, why try?
I made suggestions for the rescue of Romanian Jews and for French Jews. There was a particular scheme which was suggested by the Jewish community of Romania and which reached me through the intermediary of the International Committee of the Red Cross. And where they asked for financial help.
I was the head of the Foreign Funds Control at that time in the Treasury Department. And the government had a rather absolute policy against any private persons communicating with enemy territory.
The Treasury worked out a plan whereby we would bought the dollars in the United States and foreign currency could be borrowed against that and used abroad to get these Jews out. So the Germans wouldn't be getting the dollars, it wouldn't benefit the Germans. Well, the State Department opposed that plan from beginning to end. We had meeting after meeting.
And nothing happened. And months would go by, and we would inquire why the license hadn't been issued. And nothing happened. That was the beginning of the Treasury's interest in the problem of refugees.
In the meantime, we had strenuous objections from the British, as well as from our State Department colleagues. The British position was summed up in a cable which said that they were opposed to the rescue of these Jews, and I'll quote exactly, because of, quote, the difficulties of disposing of any considerable number of Jews should they be rescued.
Could many, maybe even most of the surviving Jews, a few of the Jews who were alive in Europe in November 42, been saved, in my opinion, definitely, yes.
How?
It's a heartbreaking statement to make, but and it haunts me, but this is my conviction. And I wish I didn't have it, but I've re-examined it, and unfortunately it holds. How, very simply, you see, if let's take fantasy and let's take reality. Fantasy is if the same kind of reaction that my colleagues from Palestine and American friends who worked with us on the Committee for the Jewish Army, if they had the same reaction that we had.
For instance, they had once advertisements that every man, American Jew, will send $1,000 will save a Romanian Jewish child. It was plain nonsense. They couldn't save with money Romanian Jewish child. But they want to get the money for their agitation.
Yes, there are some of the most difficult months and years in my life. To see and to wait, and I must say even, you know, the beauty of the landscape in Switzerland, and I was having an office and looking out on the lake and out on the beautiful mountains, the Mont Blanc, and all around the world was going to pieces, and there you had this peace and this nice atmosphere, and nothing comes, and you couldn't really impress the outside world what the tragedy was.
What would have happened if they stormed the White House? They didn't storm the White House because when we organized the demonstration of 500 rabbis, we finally managed to get one courageous Orthodox Jewish rabbi, the head of Agudas Israel, the non-Zionist outfit. Because all the rabbis boycotted us when we tried to organize. And we had a tremendously impressive march to Washington. And we got Vice President Wallace to interrupt the session of the Senate, which he presided on deliberately that day, and ask all the senators to come to the steps of Capitol Hill to receive these rabbis who arrived by special train on march to the Capitol. After Wallace made a speech and the rabbis gave him a petition, there were tremendous papers in all the press and everywhere, all these rabbis crying. We marched on the White House, and we tried for weeks before this demonstration to have Roosevelt receive the delegation just like Wallace received them.
We pray and appeal to the Lord, blessed be He, that our most gracious President Franklin Delano Roosevelt consider and recognize this momentous hour of history and the responsibility which the divine presence has laid upon him, that he may save the remnant of the people of the book, the people of Israel.
And it was the Jewish advisors, as published in a memoir of Roosevelt's secretary McIntyre, who was actually the man who received us, who says that one of the Jewish advisors said, President's Jewish friend said, these are not the kind of Jews you should associate with. And they spirited him out of the White House. Officially, they told us he's out of town. What they did is that a couple of hours earlier, they took him to a base to dedicate a bomber that was flying to Tito. This is what petrified, frightened Jews can do to themselves and to their brothers.
It seems you don't know the American situation. America, the Congress dominates.
Senator Gillette was the leader of the Senate resolution, and Congressman Will Rogers, the son of the famous Will Rogers, even though he was famous himself, was the leader of the House resolution. We introduced two concurrent resolutions in the House and in the Senate, which called on the president to establish a special commission to save the remnants of the Jewish people. And on this, the Jewish leadership and especially the Zionist leadership put monkey wrenches, because they said that you shouldn't say save the Jewish people, you should say save the Jewish people by opening the gates of Palestine. And we said that you are dooming them, because you shouldn't say save people conditionally to what?
The reports had been coming out from Switzerland as to what was happening in Germany to the Jews, and all of a sudden they stopped. And we discovered through some friends we had in the State Department that the reason they stopped was that the State Department had instructed Mr. Harrison, who was the head of the legation in Switzerland, not to forward any more private communications to the Jewish agencies here as to what was happening.
The normal attitude of the State Department in those days, and I suspect it still exists, that you don't do anything to rock the boat. You keep things calm. And the fact that millions of Jews were being murdered while they were delaying, I don't think troubled most of them.
Do you think they knew?
Well, obviously they knew. They knew from those cables. They knew from the cables they suppressed.
We discovered that, and that really led to bringing this matter to the attention of the president.
I prepared a very lengthy memorandum, the entire report to the secretary on the acquiescence of this government in the murder of the Jews. It revealed that certain State Department officials were guilty of, one, failing to use the governmental machinery at their disposal to rescue the Jews from Hitler, and even going so far as to use this governmental machinery to prevent the rescue of the Jews. Secondly, they not only failed to cooperate with private organizations in the efforts of these organizations to work out individual programs of their own, but they took steps designed to prevent these programs from being put into effect. And they not only failed to facilitate the obtaining of information concerning Hitler's plans to exterminate the Jews, but in their official capacity, they surreptitiously attempted to stop the attaining of the information concerning the murder of the Jewish people of Europe.
We said that saving the Jews is the highest priority. First of all, it is the highest priority for Jews. It's inconceivable that Jews should remain indifferent to the extermination of their brethren.
Weiss testified he got Congressman Blum to have open hearings to stymie this resolution. And he came there and he testified, naturally didn't say that it's bad to have such an agency. He said it's not enough. Well, if you say it's not enough, then it isn't good. Why should American congressmen do it if Rabbi Weiss didn't? By the way, he didn't convince them. He managed to convince Blum to pigeonhole it. It never came up for a vote in the House. But it passed unanimously in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. You know, even though once the House started hearings, the Senate was supposed to wait for it, except that, and we couldn't get the chairman, Tom Connolly, to take it up. And then one day we waited until one day he was sick, he was an old man. And the acting chairman was Senator Thomas Afuto, who was an intellectual Mormon religious man. And as a religious man, he planned it all. He is the man who told me, wait until one day I'll preside and have it passed unanimously. And he did. He said, there's no opposition to this resolution. To the contrary, we all feel it should be done. And it passed.
And that report was presented to the Secretary of the Treasury, who presented it to President Roosevelt. And I know that Secretary Morgenthau, not too long before he died, told me that that was the most shocking thing that had ever come to his attention during the time that he had served in government service. And apparently it was shocking enough to President Roosevelt that it led to the formation of the War Effigy Board.
Only when the matter was brought to the president's attention forcibly in early 1944 did the president react, but when he reacted, he went all the way.
John Paley, who of course was at that point made the director, ran this whole show, recruited his own men, many from his, in fact, most from the Treasury Department.
The mere signing of the executive order involved a complete change in American policy, because up to then, the attitude was that we had to get on with the war and we shouldn't get into problems like this. But the president in his executive order said it's now the policy of the United States government to do everything possible consistent with the war effort to aid people who were being persecuted in occupied enemy territory.
Jews could have been saved because it was possible to convince the Allies, especially the American government, that they should establish, they should accept it as a principle, they should establish a special commission to save the Jews, not the War Refugee Board, because Hitler wasn't massacring refugees, he was massacring Jews. And they should have done it a year earlier. Because the War Refugee Board was established late December 43, it was in 44 actually.
It reached a point where, as a result of so many of our battles with the State Department, I was at one point told that, by again, the same friend of mine in the State Department told me that another person in the State Department said that this Jew Morgenthau and his Jewish assistant Du Bois are trying to run the State Department. Just so happens I'm not Jewish.
The Jewish organizations, one of the reasons that they were so much against us is that we raised too much noise.
They didn't make noise?
They say it is embarrassing. It creates anti-Semitism to put the Jews, the word Jew, the slogan Jew, on the front page of newspapers, or to advertise it on in full page advertising.
So they played down, they hushed up the issue, and this was the real reason of what was happening during the years of the massacre in the United States. I showed you yesterday in this document from the State Department in which Dr. Goldman has been pressuring them to get me deported, to get me as if I was the problem, not Hitler. And in fact, then he quotes Weiss saying that I'm as bad as Hitler. And he was asked why, obviously. You know, he went on, he said, because Hitler brought anti-Semitism to Europe
and I'm bringing it to America.
Being the head of a war refugee board, and knowing it was late in the war, knowing there wasn't too much we could do, was a very disturbing experience. You found yourself sort of sick to your stomach most of the time. And you had great pressure from private groups, very understandable pressure. Sometimes the private groups didn't get along too well either. Our best cooperation, I think, came from the JDC, the Jewish Joint Distribution Committee.
And they came and they said, don't worry about any allocations. We will take care of all the money you need. And this was actually the end of the great possibilities of the War Refugee Board.
This was an all-out war, and the whole economy, the whole country was devoted to winning this war. And we had to work within those confines. We couldn't say we're going to drop the war effort and start a rescue operation. But there were many things that could be done. And we could provide facilities to the private agencies. We could let them send money in through Switzerland in ways that didn't give any foreign exchange to the Germans.
The problem of dealing with the rescue of hundreds of thousands of Jews can be only feasible if it is done by governments which have at their disposal great amounts of money.
If we would have stopped the debt machine, the debt factories, and made it a retail murder, they couldn't have murdered so many millions of people. They murdered it because they made it efficient, because they used poison gas, because they used assembly lines which were never interfered with.
The center of all of our attention on the War Refugee Board side and that of the relief, the Jewish organizations, was this massive, rapid rounding up and deportation of the Hungarian Jews, an exercise that was directed by the infamous Eichmann, and which succeeded in decimating a Jewish community of, what was it, 600,000 or 800,000 people within a space of about 3 months. People were being deported at a rhythm of 12,000 a day out of Hungary north to Auschwitz. In that connection, since this terrible installation was working night and day, the suggestion was made, and I think for the first time to me by Dr. Sternbuch, the Union of Orthodox Rabbis, and possibly Gerhard Riegner, who had was familiar with the original report, that an effort might be made to bomb the rail lines leading to Auschwitz as one means of at least temporarily halting this massive deportation of Jews from Hungary. Once that recommendation had been sent to Washington, it was pretty well out of my hand.
At the time it was first raised that we should get the Air Force to bomb Auschwitz, the War Refugee Board staff itself was very leery of this. There'd be bound to be loss of life connected with it. Could we ask American flyers to do this? We worried about the effect on the, even on the Germans, of our action if we wiped out a lot of the people we were trying to save. And so initially we were not at all enthusiastic about this.
This is a cause of saving human life that anybody who thinks it through, I think, would want to be a part of the action. I felt that way. When the Germans were stepping up their extermination programs, the people in the Polish government kept us continually advised on that, what they were doing. And the Polish government felt that Auschwitz should be bombed. I thought about that very carefully and sent a cable to Washington with that recommendation. That had been brought up several times before. However, the cable that I sent sort of raised the matter again. I thought made sense to bomb these camps.
Later, when the extent of what was going on in the exterminating the Jews became clearer, we did press it with the War Department. And the War Department told us it wasn't operationally feasible, that we didn't have planes that could accompany bombers all the way from England to Auschwitz and return. And there was bound to be a large loss of life, and they weren't willing to do it.
General McCloy was later High Commissioner in Germany, later President of the Chase Bank, a good friend of mine. I talked to McCloy only 2-3 years ago about it, and he confirmed my impression that the main responsible for not doing it was the English High Command. Anyhow, this wasn't done.
And later you found out?
Later, apparently, it has come to light that there were bombing raids going on from Italy, bases in Italy, to areas very close to Auschwitz. So perhaps it could have been bombed.
The revelation of German atrocities in Poland, Norway, France, and Belgium, and the fully authenticated evidence of mass killings leaves the American people horror-stricken. We cannot help but gasp at the mass exterminations carried out over a 3-year period in Lublin. We subscribe to our government's determination that Germany be held responsible for any reprisals against the Polish Home Army in Warsaw. We of the American Legion have been particularly shocked by the Grenoble atrocities, the Nazis' planned mutilation of men, women, and children, the unwarranted execution of civilians, as well as members of the French forces of the interior. The crimes of the Nazis have been unspeakable. With the increased pace of Allied victories, the day of reckoning is near, and every German realizes that the Allies will come marching into Berlin with the crimes of Lublin, Grenoble, and Ludice, as well as those which occurred in other cities, towns, and villages overrun by the Hun, vivid in every soldier's mind.
How could you have stopped?
Well, there's this famous business of bombing the railroads continuously. And this wasn't done, but this would have slowed it. Would have slowed it, but not meaningfully. The one concrete solution was made in a by us in telegrams early in 1944, I believe. The Allies warned Germany that if they will use poison gas on any place against any people, the Allies will retaliate and kite upon Germany any place they'll choose. And this was done after it was known that they have killed more than 1 million Jews by poison gas, maybe 2 million. So immediately we sent telegrams to Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, and pressure. There was already a war refugee board, pressure the war refugee board that they should issue another statement amplifying it and including the Jews and warning them that if you don't, since it's known that you're using gas to kill Jews, if you're not going to stop it, they will use gas against you. That is a pretty serious step. Granted, and I made it later on in a speech as chairman of the Hebrew Committee of National Liberation in town hall, which was broadcast on the radio, and everybody got a shudder. They thought I was too irresponsible. There was no comments. They thought it's such a frightening proposition. And I'm asking you again the question, why did the Allies threaten the Germans to use poison gas against them if they use it against Greek farmers or Polish officers or Norwegian seamen? And not against Jews. Why was it so outrageous to say that you should use poison gas if you kill Jews? I say it was a crime that they didn't do it. Because this was encouragement. And we said so. We had a phrase, we said, to the criminal Nazi mind, this is encouragement. And this was encouragement.
While I was in New York preparing to go to Turkey, I met a number of Jewish leaders. And I was put on to the former Romanian ambassador to the United States. He had defected from Romania and stayed in the United States as a result of Hitler taking over Romania. He gave me a letter to his friend Alexander Cristiano, who was ambassador to Turkey. And he said, you tell my friend Cristiano he better get out there. The Germans are going to lose and he's going to get trapped and killed. We sat in a small room and each took out
pencils, and he was a very dapper, good-looking man, spoke perfect English, and talked and talked about nothing for some time, getting nowhere, and I suddenly, in a rather undiplomatic way, turned around and said, "Mr. Ambassador, you're going to get killed, you and your family." He looked back, startled. I said, "There are military reports, which you must have also, indicate that the Russians are on their way to Bessarabia, and the first thing he'll do is get hold of you and Antonescu, the head of the Romanian government, and they will take over Romania." And he said, "Well, so what?" I said, "Well, there's a way of your being saved." And I said, "If there is a camp in Transnistria which is incarcerated, about 100,000 Jews are left, they're dying at the rate of 100,000 a day, all you do is open that camp, and I will arrange to get you and your family a visa to the United States."
We could see that the Germans were warned repeatedly that the crimes against the Jews wouldn't be forgotten after the war. And this became more important and more effective as the war drew to a close, and even the Germans could see they were going
to
lose.
On Monday, Simon came rushing to me in the embassy, saying he's back, he has seen Antonescu, and he's ready to make the deal. Which was shocking to me, because I had no authority. I was just talking out of my head.
Earlier in the game, when they thought they could conquer the world, they wouldn't pay too much attention to warnings. But at this point, the warnings tended to strike home.
The 100,000 were released. Many thousands did manage to come through on the little boats to Istanbul, and then transported to what was then Palestine.
I would like to know whether it would be possible, like they did America, which that large, big, huge country. It's one of the largest and huge, most huge country in the world. Why couldn't they do the same thing in turn, let's say 100,000, 200,000, intern them over here, like we were interned in Switzerland?
I made the recommendation to John Pell, who passed it on to Secretary Morgenthau, that it would be better to treat the Jews as prisoners of war than to let them die. And I suggested that we set up prisoner of war camps in the United States, in which we could bring these people and keep them there and then send them back then, if you want, after the war is over. Meantime, treat them as prisoners of war. I prepared a memorandum on that. Secretary Morgenthau took the idea to President Roosevelt, whom magnanimously, I say that with some sarcasm, agreed to set up such a haven in the United States. And he picked out an army camp, an abandoned army camp in Oswego, which would take 1,000 persons. And that was the result of that program. We did receive 1,000 people. But to me, although it had a psychological impact, it was far, far below what this government should have done. There's no reason why we shouldn't have been made an offer to Louis. Well, how's anybody here you're willing to let out?
We signed a paper. We had to go back from where we came from. That was Naples, right?
Where were you staying?
In Oswego. That was formerly army camp. That was evacuated for us and renovated. It was a very nice camp, but we had only 6 hours daily. We could go out of the town, you know. We were always under police protection. So, really, we were interned. It was a 10-foot wire around the camp. We couldn't go out without a permission. Mrs. Roosevelt, after 2-3 months we were in that camp, she visited us. And she told us about the whole story about the Congress and Senate, and said we are a political playboy. You call that playball?
Football.
Football.
Why did people like you help?
Well, as I say, even I felt it was my duty to help in something like this.
What about the people who didn't feel it was their duty?
Well, I can't speak for them. There are some people who apparently just had no feelings at all for something like this. I don't know why. I can't answer that question.
I had been urged not to come. Everybody around me in my work as vice president of Bloomingdale's and my family and all said, you're crazy to go to Turkey. What can you do against all the enemy in the middle of the war? What can one man do? And at that point, I made a little note in my diary which said, never indulge in hesitant mercy.
Most dreadful of all the camps was at Buchenwald, where only 20,000 of the original 80,000 were found alive. This murder weapon accounted for hundreds of deaths and the disfigurement of thousands of others. Of the quarter of the prison population left alive when rescued by the Americans, thousands were beyond human aid. Easy death was the most that life could offer them. Slave laborers worked on the V-2 bomb, serial numbers tattooed on their stomachs. Six furnaces, each holding three bodies, were used in cremating the dead and often the living. Don't turn away, look. Burned alive. Horror unbelievable, yet true.
While in the United States on one of my return trips, I came back and forth several times from Ankara to report to the State Department. Also, I felt I should get back to my business. This is 1944, and I'd left the vice presidency of Bloomingdale's, but they kept, Morgenthau and Secretary Hall kept saying, no, you got to go back, you're doing fine, so forth. And while there, I suddenly got a message that I was at once to be prepared to fly off back to Istanbul the next day. I was escorted into the president's office very briefly, and he said, they had told me beforehand, the boys in Paley's office, and they were these in Paley's entourage, his group of young vital assistants, said, look, two agents, German agents, have come to Istanbul, gone to Istanbul from Eichmann with a deal for trucks and money in exchange for Jewish lives.
The Germans have shown from the very day they came to power till the very last day that they are willing to do business as far as releasing the Jews are concerned, as far as stopping the slaughter.
They had him in some apartment house overlooking the Nile, and I talked with Brandt for hours. And one of the things Brandt said to me that I thought was significant, I said, well, we can't do anything about trucks. We're not going to give the enemy equipment. I can't get our collaborators in this war to give equipment to the enemy. But money, yes, we can make some deal. I said, now how about these men, Eichmann and the men around him? Can't we do some bribery? Are they approachable? And Brad looked at me and said, Are you kidding? Talked English. He had worked in Brooklyn some years back as a young man and talked some English. Are you kidding? He said, they can all be bought. You are dealing, you're dealing with men of the lowest character. You're dealing with bandits.
When it was unsuccessful in the East, which plans, I think, which were to get people out through Romania and onto boats in the Black Sea and out of Europe, it moved westward.
The talks were switched to Switzerland because the British would not permit any deal to be made.
Well, I really only saw Becker, who represented the Nazi, a wing of the SS in Hungary. It was not directly the extermination wing, but an economic wing of the SS, whom he led us to believe had convinced Himmler that trying to get something out of the Allies, the Americans in particular, in return for stopping the Jewish deportations was worth undertaking.
We learned through Switzerland that you could possibly get into some negotiations with some of the top Germans
because at that time the war was beginning to have a predictable end. So very carefully we negotiated.
Washington took a very nervous view, not to speak of the view that the British and let alone the Russians took of any such talks going on, that they should not be conducted directly in the name of the United States, because, of course, what the Nazis were after were goods, material, money, in return for the release of people, which was a ransom negotiation, which none of us could enter into with any enthusiasm.
There was a elderly Jewish merchant named Sally Meyer in Switzerland who was very highly regarded and who was very helpful in these negotiations.
Poor Sally really had no cards in his hand.
Money.
Except at the very end we succeeded in getting $5 million transferred to an account in the Swiss National Bank in Zurich, which was in Sally's and my name, which was so tied down we never could have used it, actually, although the Nazis on at least two and possibly three occasions turned up on the border at St. Margaretin with a satchel to put the money into.
The most strongest argument of Weissmandl that I know of, that he told, what do you risk? Even if your money will get lost, you lost practically nothing. You lost money that can always be recovered, can always be gained again. We are losing, our stake is our very lives.
One suggestion was that we supply trucks to the Germans in exchange for their letting people out. We, of course, had no intention of supplying trucks under any circumstance, or money. But the negotiations, we felt, would, at best, delay what was going on.
And I was informed first about the Joel Brandt story by Stettinius, who was at that time Secretary of State. I was the only one to whom he showed the original cable, and I advised him to accept the German offer and to drag on, because 3,000 trucks, I think that was the number the Germans asked for, cannot be delivered in 1 week. It's not like you go into a shop and you buy herring. So I said the war is already in this final stage, drag it on.
I'm sure Washington didn't want it to come out that some American official representing the War Refugee Board was negotiating with the Nazis for ransom.
And some deal was made with Eichmann. He wanted money for the Jews.
Huh?
He wanted money. Hitler wanted money for the Jews.
That's it?
Yeah. Yeah. Did you say? Yeah. Yeah. Every Jew, $1,000.
But there wasn't so much on to the United States. We wasn't so much worth to them.
And so these negotiations went on with the State Department approval. They never ended in any agreement. And we had to be very careful because the Russians were very suspicious of any negotiations with the Germans.
I've always thought if we had a tenth of the resources the OSS had had, we could have done a lot of things.
Ridden with all the worst diseases known to mankind, and without medical attention or food enough to keep them alive, the prisoners died daily by the hundreds after rescue, despite any aid we could give them. American officers rounded up civilians and forced them to atone, in a small degree, for what their countrymen had done. Protesting, with the stench of death in their nostrils, they were forced to remove the victims to a hillside grave for better burial. For the first time, America can believe what they thought was impossible propaganda. Here is documentary evidence of sheer mass murder. Murder that will blacken the name of Germany for the rest of recorded history.
Your question whether the Jews could have been saved, obviously not. Jews could have been saved. The proof is very simple. As the whole horror was over, hundreds of thousands of Jews survived. If we, the Jews, would have done our job better, if even we on the committee did our job better, I mean, we tried our utmost, but obviously we could have done more. If the Jewish leadership would have acted, if the Jews would have acted, the number of the survivors could have been doubled, tripled, fourfold. I don't want to make conjecture, but I think it's important to know that the number of people who survived was up to us, and if it was so small, it was the inadequacy of our activities. And if I were a Jewish leader, dead, I'd probably turning in grave, and if I was alive, I would have a very guilty conscience.
Finally, about what you did, do you feel that, in other words, when you were doing it, you said you knew what was going on, you knew the pressure. Mm-hmm. After the war, when you saw the pictures or mm-hmm. whatever, mm-hmm. what were your feelings then?
The feelings of any civilized human being that it's hard to believe that such things could happen.
And about the work you did in relation to that?
Little enough. Late and little, I would say.
From North Jefferson County, Kansas, smack dab between Kansas City, Topeka, Lawrence, Atchison. Easiest way to describe it. Put together quite a good show. I think you're going to like it.
Radio Free Kansas on blogtalkradio.com/fightingcockfire.
Anarchism is not bombs, disorder, or chaos. It is not robbery and murder. It is not a war of each against all.
Tune in to Subversion 1312, the 4ZZZ Anarchy Show.
Tuesday from 9 till 10 p.m. on 102.1 FM. Or streaming 4ZZZFM.org.au.
How about trying this future on for size?
Hello, I am Susan Aglukkaq. The North has the highest incidence of sexually transmitted diseases, STDs, in the country. We also have a high rate of teenage pregnancies. High-risk behaviors, unprotected sex, lead to the spread of HIV/AIDS. It can be prevented. Learn the ways to protect yourself and others. Knowledge is power.
Go ahead, ready?
I'm Forrest Whitaker for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and this is my daughter, True.
Hi.
Life is full of choices, and many years ago, I chose to become a vegetarian, and it's one of the best choices I've ever made. And since True's dad was a vegetarian, she decided to be vegetarian, too. You may decide to go vegetarian for better health, for a better environment, or you could be like True and I and just decide you don't want to eat meat anymore.
I love animals and I love being a vegetarian.
I'm Forrest Whitaker.
And I'm True Whitaker.
And we're vegetarians.
For more information, visit PETA.org.
Only 28% of Americans believe in evolution.
62% want creation science taught along with evolution in our schools.
44% want creation science taught exclusively.
You are all about to learn that you didn't come from monkeys and slime. All of you were created in the image and likeness of God.
But didn't we evolve from prior organisms?
Yes, we did. Those organisms were named Adam and Eve.
Then why do we share 99% of our DNA with chimpanzees?
The Bible doesn't teach about chimpanzees.
What about redundant DNA, a junk DNA? Does the Bible teach about that?
Well, I can tell you one thing. There's no redundant DNA in hell.
Our children are our future.
Let's try not to turn them into dangerous idiots.
This is episode reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
Fuck you, Trump. We'll see you on the streets. Am I disappointed? Yes. But am I surprised? Hell no.
It clearly shows what the country is made up of, what the country was founded on.
Darwin described the United States as a greedy, hypocritical, racist, white supremacist, evil, warmongering nation.
Donald Trump is just a symptom of a greater system that has basically f***ed up for my people for over 500 years.
To me, the United States was founded in violence, developed in violence, and violence is an American, U.S. American tradition.
The thing that's rattling around in my brain is all of this militarized police and the attacks and everything that's been happening happened under the Obama administration. And I can't help but question what might happen under a Trump administration.
Now we have a really strong enemy to organize against that causes us to say, hey, we gotta get together.
Eleven Roberts.
Company?
I thought you called. Did you call?
No, but it wasn't too early to be bothering you. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm playing. How many boyfriends you have?
Why you all in my Kool-Aid? Why you over here?
Just answer that again.
Typical fucking niggers. Somebody calling this shit is random.
Alright, you know, okay. Come on.
Find out what radio that comment came from.
You know, we don't get radio numbers, but I'm already hollering for my supervisor.
Yes, Cause I'm like this more than say.
I'm like right at the matter, man. Fucking nigga.
White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
We are the Ku Klux Klan. We hate niggers, we hate Jews, we hate faggots, and we hate specs. We don't have to have a reason to hate it. People need to get off your ass and wake up. This is America.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
This ends our news flash.
Skinhead!
Skinhead walks down the street, every cheek hard, skips a beat. When a skinhead walks down the street, every cheek hard,
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're going to spend the hour looking at the perils of nuclear power, nuclear energy, and citizen science and activism. We are joined, the first part of the program, by filmmaker Robbie Lepser. We'll be talking about his new film, Power Struggle.